Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening pleasure of the Five Eyes Network, the UK included with Australia, New Zealand, America and Canada. It's illegal to spy on their own citizens, but it ain't illegal if you spy on the other people's citizens and then just share the fucking information. It's called a loophole, ladies and gentlemen, and we have all fallen through it. So, ladies and gentlemen of the intelligence agencies, welcome. My very special guest joining me today is none other than Ralph Ellis from Ed Fu Books. He is an educational kung fu master, hence the Ed Fu. Welcome to the show, bro.
Good to be with you again. It's been a long time, hasn't it?
Jesus, how long has it been? It's been like, what, 2-3 years or something?
Something like that, yeah.
I don't know what it is. As soon as you get past the age of 30, years just start disappearing immediately, you know? Where did it go? I don't know. Anyway, today we're going to be talking about something a little bit different to what we talked about last time, although I recall our last conversation, it came up at one point that you go, you took some time off and then you did some huge climate change study or something, and I went, as you do, you know?
Take 2 years of your time out of your life and off you go.
Yeah. It's a bit of a strange thing. So human beings do what we're passionate to do, and usually we come up with something unique to contribute to the human experience of education and what have you. Very few of us anyway. So, if you wouldn't mind, before we get into your presentation, just give us a little bit about who you are, what it is you do, and then we'll get straight back into it.
Yeah, okay. My name's Ralph Ellis. I normally do revisionary theology, so I'm finding the biblical characters and events in historical record, which has been very successful, actually. I found all of the biblical characters, including Jesus, as historical characters. So it's all interesting stuff. And I've written 10 books now, I think, on the subject. So, yeah, quite prolific. But as you say, I took this 2 years off, went down to Spain, and I had 2 years to myself, not doing very much else. And I just finished, actually, one of these books. I'd just finished The Grail Cipher, which was my interpretation of Arthurian legend, a reinterpretation of Arthurian legend. That's quite interesting, actually. We ought to talk about that sometime. And I had some time left over, so I thought, what shall I do? Well, I was interested in all of this climate change business, and I was blogging on this website, and it transpired that nobody knew how the glacial cycle worked. Even today, you know, 21st century, nobody knew how the interglacial and glacial cycle worked, which I found quite strange because, you know, the science is supposed to be settled. So I decided to go and find out. And I wrote this paper, which has been very successful, 22,000 downloads so far, which is unusual for a science paper. You know, a lot of science papers just go around the university. You know, they get 150 downloads. I've got 22,000 downloads on mine so far. It's one of the greatest number of downloads for a science paper. This was 2 years ago. So it's been quite successful, and nobody's been able to knock it down so far, which is quite interesting.
Well, what have you found?
Well, that climate scientists are wrong. Obviously, for the I'm not sure if we're going to go through the whole of the paper here, but climate scientists will say that the interglacial cycle is controlled by orbital cycles, which it is. My paper says exactly the same, but it requires a feedback agent. And of course, for climate scientists, everything is controlled by CO2. And so they said that the feedback agent that controls interglacial warming is CO2. But they're wrong. Because, well, for many reasons, but the main reason is, if you think about it, when you're at the top of the interglacial, at the warm period, CO2 is high. And when CO2 is high, the world cools. And then you go all the way down into the deep, you know, glacial period, 100,000 years of cooling until you get right to the bottom of the glacial period. When CO2 is low, the world warms.
Do you have a graph or something like that to show us?
No, I didn't put that one up. I didn't know we were going to talk about that. But
regardless,
no, I don't.
If you don't, yeah. It doesn't matter. Continue, continue.
Yeah. Well, on my paper, you see, I have all these graphs, you see, which I don't actually have here. And you get these glacial cycles. They go up and down, up and down, up and down. And CO2 follows the glacial cycle.
How big is the lag?
Well, it's about 700 years, normally, they say.
That's the same lag as the oceans.
Yes, it is, isn't it? So what's happening, of course, is that CO2 level concentrations are being controlled by the oceans. The colder the oceans get, the more CO2 can be absorbed by the oceans. And so CO2 is following the oceans. Mm. It's not the other way around. It's not CO2 controlling temperature. It's temperature controlling CO2. Because in those days, of course, there were no factory output. So this was just natural CO2 variations. And the natural CO2 variation follows the temperature cycle. So if CO2 is not causing the changes in temperature, then you've got to find another feedback agent. And that is what my paper was all about, was trying to find a new feedback agent. So the answer was albedo, snow and ice on the poles.
Oh, okay. I thought that was to do with a healthy sex life, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that as well, maybe. Rolling in the snow. No, albedo is the reflectivity of the Earth. So we get this high albedo with lots and lots of snow and ice on the ground. And especially during the summer when, you know, the northern hemisphere is pointing towards the sun, all of that insolation, they call it, the sunlight, gets reflected away. So it has a great cooling effect on world temperature.
Hmm.
So you can have this feedback agent from albedo much more than you can with CO2. But then you end up with this ice age world with ice all over the place, with high albedo, which makes it cool because it's reflecting all the sunlight. And then you've got to have some way of changing the snow, to darken the snow, to put dust and soot or something all over the snow to make it darker, to reduce its albedo. And the question is, how can you do that? And the answer is by low CO2. So what happens is that as CO2 gets lower and lower and lower, plants begin to die because CO2 is plant food. With CO2, I mean, I do hate it sometimes when they don't mention this, you know, in newspapers, BBC, CNN, even scientists, that CO2 is the most important gas in the atmosphere. Without CO2, everything on Earth dies. Because it's plant food. Without plant food, all the plants die. Without plants, all of the animals die. So it's the bottom of the food chain is CO2. Without CO2, everything on Earth dies. So during the ice age period, the CO2 levels come down to 180, 190 parts per million. But up in the high-level plateaus, like on the Gobi Plateau in China, it's even reduced further, because the partial pressure is less. It's like going to the top of Everest. You start running out of oxygen. And all the plants die. And suddenly, the Gobi Desert, which is normally a steppe grassland, turns into a shifting sand desert. And so now all of this dust from the Gobi gets blown all over the northern hemisphere. And we know this because of the lowest plateau in China, which records all of this dust that came off the Gobi Desert. And it just covered all of the ice sheets. And we know this because the ice cores have recorded it. So if when they do these ice core analyses, they do this drilling through the remaining ice that we've got in Greenland and in Antarctica. When you go through all of the ice cores, you get these great dust layers right at the end of each glacial cycle. So when the world is coldest and when the CO2 is lowest, suddenly you get dust. Why do you get dust? Because CO2 is low, all the plants die, and we get CO2 deserts, which is a lovely descriptive term. I love that term. A CO2 desert. So this is not an aridity desert. This is not a water desert. This is a CO2 desert because of all the plants have died because there is not enough CO2. And for some reason, climate scientists and even biologists have negated to actually research this problem with reduced CO2. I think they've been so obsessed with this CO2 business, and they believe their own propaganda that CO2 is a poison, you know, and they've never researched this. Because I came across these papers about global climate in the tropics, and they were trying to derive the climate in the tropics, paleoclimate. This is going back thousands of years through the ice ages. They were trying to derive the temperature via tree lines, which sounds sensible. You know, you've got a tree line, and the trees obviously stop growing as you get higher because it gets colder. And so from that, you know, you can infer what the temperature was thousands of years ago. Okay, nice little project. Go down to South America and you can measure the tree lines and you can find out what the temperature was. But that's all they did. They just took the temperatures. And then they ended up with these huge great lapse rates because the temperatures didn't agree with the surface temperatures. And so, you know, the normal lapse rate is, you know, 2 degrees per 1,000 foot. Is the reduction in temperature as you go up a hillside. And they ended up with these enormous lapse rates because they had these very, very cold temperatures at the top of these mountains. Well, what they hadn't done, and it's crazy that they hadn't done, is they hadn't taken CO2 into account. So the tree lines were not being taken down by temperature, they were being taken down by a lack of CO2. It was the CO2, lack of CO2, that was killing the trees.
Now, I'm of a conspiracy mindset, so the stuff that I look at, it's like, okay, it's essential for life. The people who run the world don't like life in general and want to exterminate most of it. So, you know, it just sort of fits.
Yeah, I can't believe that they actually missed this out. So a lot of their paleoclimatic temperatures are wrong because they've taken the temperature instead of the CO2, tree lines. And so they've disregarded CO2 completely. Well, they did exactly the same with the ice ages. So they disregarded CO2 and albedo. They disregarded albedo. They concentrated on CO2. And they didn't realize that a lack of CO2 is important because it will kill all the plants. So what happens, of course, is the plants all die because of a lack of CO2. You get dust spread all over the northern ice sheets. And then when you get the next orbital cycle, because we have these wonderful orbital cycles that come around that warm the planet every 22,000 years. So you get this cycle of warm and cold. It's a bit like, I call them the great year, and I use this great year quite a lot in my historical research because the Egyptians knew all about the great year. The great year is caused by the precession of the equinox, by the precession of the signs of the zodiac. So when I talk about signs of the zodiac, it's all part and parcel of the same thing. When these signs of the zodiac change throughout Egyptian history from Taurus to Aries and from Aries to Pisces, and that's why Jesus was born as a Lamb of God. He was born under Pisces, but he became a fisher of men. He was born under Aries and went into Pisces. That's all the precession of the equinox. It's the same thing. It's the great year, which lasts in climate terms 22,000 years. So we get this cycle of warm and cold in each hemisphere, exactly the same as a normal year. So, you know, during a normal year, we'll have summer in the north and winter in the south, and vice versa. Well, they do the same with a great year. when we have summer in the north for 10,000 years, they'll have a winter in the south, etc., etc. And this is a great proof that CO2 does not control ice age interglacials, because interglacials only happen during a northern great summer. Now, if CO2 was the feedback agent, then you would have interglacials either on a northern summer or a southern summer. You know, you get them equally between one and the two, but we don't. We only ever get interglacials on a northern summer. Why? Because all the continents are in the northern hemisphere.
And apart from Australia, of course, and South America.
You don't get much ice on Australia much, do you?
Not really. I mean, there's this giant Antarctic thing that's like not too far from New Zealand, and it's like freezing as hell. I don't know why. They've got a whole bunch of facilities and stuff down there now that they don't tell people about, and it's a freaky thing. But anyway, that's kind of off topic.
It's kind of off topic. But Antarctica doesn't grow much because it's surrounded by oceans, which keeps it warm. But in the northern hemisphere, it's surrounded by lots and lots of continents. And that's why you get the great ice age ice sheets all occur in the north. So all of the albedo changes happen in the north, not in the south. And the ice ages happen in the north, not in the south. Which is a good clue that CO2 is not involved in this, because CO2 is global as a feedback agent, but albedo is not. It only happens in the north because that is where all of the ice sheets are. And so you get all of this dust that falls on these northern ice sheets, and then we get this great summer business when the Earth tilts more towards the sun during the northern hemisphere summer, and suddenly all of that snow can melt. Because if you're looking at CO2 as a feedback agent, it gives, they say it gives about 3 or 4 watts per square meter on the surface of the Earth. That's how much it gives, which is not a lot. You think about 3 or 4 watts. What's that? This is like a bicycle lamp, you know, is used to be 3 watts. Well, think of how warm that is. Bicycle lamps, not very warm, is it? Per square meter. So it's nothing really. And that is over a full 5,000 years of an interglacial. But in albedo, you can get 200 watts per square meter from day one, not over 5,000 years, but from day one. So it's much, much more powerful than the CO2 feedback system. And I've had a few complaints. Some scientists said, "Oh no, you're wrong, because you've got to calculate albedo globally because it's global warming. You've got to calculate it globally." I said, "No. Why should I calculate it globally? You know, during an annual winter, we get snow all over Canada and North America. What melts the snow? Is it the sunshine in Canada during the spring and the summer, or is it the temperature in Argentina? Quite obviously, it's regional warming that counts. It's not global warming that counts, that melts the snow in an annual winter. And it's exactly the same with the great winter, with the ice ages. It's the regional insulation, the actual sunlight from the sun during the great summer, with all the ice that's now dark because it's covered in ice. Sorry, it's covered in dust. And now it can melt. And it melts very, very, very quickly as well. It melts in 5,000 years. It all just disappears. So it takes 100,000 years to build up this ice. And then it all melts within 5,000 years. It's a very, very strong warming agent. And CO2 is just not strong enough. It can't do that. But albedo at 200 watts per square meter is an enormous amount of heating. And it can keep that heating going for all that time, you know, for the whole 5,000 years. And that's what controls the ice ages. And so I wrote this paper. It's called The Modulation of Ice Ages Via Dust and Albedo. And you can look it up on the web. You just type that in for a Google search, Modulation of Ice Ages by Dust and Albedo. And it'll come up. It's a standard science paper. It was published by Elsevier. And it was I actually did it through Beijing University. So I'm an honorary member of Beijing University. And they paid for it, which was very nice. So,
yeah. Well, I was thinking as well about the climate change movement, essentially. It's talking about how bad CO2 is and carbon dioxide and that kind of thing, whereas carbon dioxide is not so much as poisonous for people as carbon monoxide is, which actually comes out of people's exhausts, right? And I thought to myself,
if they've got it wrong sometimes.
Well, it's when people are wrong, they will refuse to admit it. And in fact, they will double down on being wrong, and they will indeed get really, really angry and attempt to threaten and cajole whoever it is that's opposing them with facts. And they believe that their opinion is a fact, and they can't tell the difference. Right. And this is all human beings. This is all beliefs. This is cognitive dissonance. This is what happens. So it's unsurprising that if you tell a climate cultist that you're God, the UN is wrong about stuff, they will treat you as a heretic.
Oh, they do. They do. I had this on a blog recently. It was a newspaper blog. And this guy chirped up and said, but CO2 is a poison. It's a poison. You will die if it gets too high. And I replied that, during the Jurassic period, CO2 was six times higher than it is now. It was 2,500 parts per million. We've only got 400 at present, and they think that's high. You know, it was much, much higher during the Cretaceous and the Jurassic period. And did animals die? No, they didn't.
In fact, the exact opposite happened. Life flourished, and it became way, way larger. And now that CO2 levels are much, much down, the largest land mammal we've got is like an elephant. You know,
because
way back in the day, it could have been eaten by one of these things.
CO2 is the bottom of the food chain. If you have more CO2, you get bigger plants. If you get bigger plants, you have bigger herbivores. If you get bigger herbivores, you get bigger carnivores. The whole of the dinosaur era was fueled by CO2.
Well, if that's the case, then we need to carbon dioxide the fuck out of this planet. I mean, people are running out of food.
A lot of people have said that that man is the savior of the animal kingdoms, the savior of all life on Earth, because what was happening before is that plant life was locking up CO2. That's what it does. Plants eat CO2, and they lock them up in coal seams and oil seams and gas and all the rest of it. They all get layered down over millions of years. And that has dragged the CO2 content in the atmosphere down and down over millions of years. And if that had continued, then all life on Earth would have died, because it would have run out of CO2. And what man has done, we're almost like a natural agent. You know, nature saw that we were running out of CO2 and we desperately needed some more of it. And so man was invented to go and dig it up and burn it and put it back into the atmosphere and save all life on Earth. You know, I mean, if you're into, what do they call it? Intelligent design. If you're into intelligent design, surely that's the sign of a god. You know, why else is man here if not to dig up coal and burn it and put it back into the atmosphere?
Well, George Carlin made a similar point. He said, maybe the Earth made us because we could create plastic and it wanted it for itself. You know, the answer to the age-old question, why are we here? Plastic assholes.
By plastic or CO2, one of the two.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that in jest, one can often touch upon truth, can they not? And this is the interesting part of it as well, because if we've actually discovered a feedback loop within the Earth's system, and we are actually an integral part of that feedback loop, then that gives us a purpose beyond just having, there's a God, and he made us, yeah, and then we've got a purpose now, because he's big, because somebody said so in a book. The book that was written by God? Yep. What does it say on the front of it? The King James Version? And God wrote that, yeah? Not King James? Yeah. Facts are really, really unsettling, and because they don't allow you to just like retreat back and go, oh, I don't want to hear this, or whatever facts are, and they don't care what you think about them. It's kind of like Donald Trump, you know, Donald Trump is a fact, and he just doesn't care what you think about him. It just is.
Yeah, that's true as well.
I can't believe I came up with that example off the top of my head. God damn, I'm good. Like, I was trying to come up with a human being that actually embodied that. Oh, there it is. Fuck. Oh, shit. Oh, God. Okay, so. Getting back into it, this whole carbon cycle, if you've actually sussed out that is the whole cause, essentially, if that's our life cycle and we're here right now and we're actually saving all of these kind of things, there'd be an argument, of course, from people saying, oh, but we're killing 20,000 species a year or whatever, and then you could hit back, well, it'd be 30,000 species a year if we weren't pumping the atmosphere full of CO2, and it would include 10,000 plant species a year or something like that, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm not even sure that we're actually killing any species at all. I mean, all we're doing is returning the climate back to what it was just 9,000 years ago. Again, another of these facts. This is what I was going through. I made these videos. I've just started this video channel, which is YouTube/C/RalphEllis is my channel. And I've been going through these things where, you know, academia has been economical with the truth. And of course, with the studies I've done, I've been looking at theologians and historians being economical with the truth, missing the obvious, you know, in their field of study. And then I came on, of course, to climate scientists missing the obvious. But they cannot miss the obvious. They must know about it. But they're not telling us about it. And the media are not telling us about it. So somewhere along the line, someone is refusing to tell us the basic facts that we need to know. And one of the basic facts is that during the Holocene maximum, which was only 9,000 years ago, it was 2 degrees warmer than now. So they're all jumping up and down and saying, oh, we're going to warm, it's going to kill all the animals. Well, hold on a minute. 9,000 years ago, the world was 2 degrees warmer than now. It's called the Holocene maximum. You can look it up. And during the Holocene maximum, plant life flourished. The northern tree line was 200 kilometers further north in Siberia and Canada because the trees could grow further north. It was warmer. The Sahara Desert was green. It was fertile. It was farmed. 9,000 years ago during the Holocene maximum when it was warmer. So these are basic facts. You can look this up anywhere. But what this means is that warm temperatures are not going to destroy life on Earth. We know that because it didn't destroy life 9,000 years ago. And yet still we have scientists, we have media reporters, we have, you know, people who should know better in science magazines saying that 2 degrees will kill all life on Earth. You know, even that brain-dead senator. No, she's not a senator. She's
Cortez or whatever her name is.
Yeah, Cortez. Yeah, she's not a senator. She's just one of the MPs, basically, isn't she?
A congresswoman.
Yeah, that's the one. She said the world will end in 12 years' time because of warming.
Like, if it goes up 700 degrees like it did in the last days or something like that, sure. But that's not going to fucking happen.
Yeah, well, but she's not pointing out, and someone must have briefed her on this because she knows nothing. She's just an airhead. But someone must have briefed her on what's happening, you know, with part of her Green Deal that she's brought out. But no one told her that 9,000 years ago, it was warmer then than it is now. I have some graphs for that. This is a bit I do have graphs for.
You'll have to share your screen in order for the audience to be able to see those, of course. You remember the little plus symbol and the share screen?
Okay, and we come up with that. Does that work?
Not yet. You've got to click that. Oh, there we go. Now it's working. Cool.
Oh, because I can't see it. All I can see is you. Okay. Right. So that is.
If you full screen that image, it'll help us to see it more clearly.
Let me try that. Oh no, that's the wrong button. I need to press the green one, not that one.
Yeah.
I'm great with these computers, you know. If I press the green one, it'll do that. Unfortunately, it doesn't grow that much, but there we go.
And also, if you hold your command key and then you roll your mouse button forward, you can zoom in on stuff.
I don't have a mouse.
You haven't checked the accessibility one on that. No problem. I'll just enlarge it on the screen for the audience's sake. That's all right. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, that's an image of Holocene temperatures versus that's the one we want. Holocene temperatures versus CO2. So this is a graph that goes back 11,000 years from now. That steep rise in the blue you see there, that is the rise from the glacial period. That's the interglacial warming. And it got very warm, and it got warmer and warmer and warmer. And then since 9,000, 8,000 years ago, it started to gently cool. And it's cooled 2 degrees in the last 9,000 years. Now, the red plot down the bottom, that is CO2. So as CO2 was rising, temperatures were falling.
Mm.
Now, there's a basic disconnect here because we're always told the opposite. You know, if CO2 is rising, temperatures have got to rise because the only thing that controls temperature is CO2. Well, not during the Holocene, it wasn't. During the Holocene, as CO2 rose, temperatures fell. So, yeah, we have a problem there with the theory. The theory is wrong from the starters.
Mm.
But if we just scroll up a minute, here is Holocene temperatures versus obliquity. This is the angle of the tilt angle of the axis of the Earth. Which changes over 40,000 years. If we compare the temperatures with obliquity, we see it is following obliquity very closely.
Mm.
And there is a good reason for that, because this interglacial is an obliquity-led interglacial, because there's not much precession around at present due to the orbit of the Earth because of eccentricity. And so the temperature on Earth is controlled more by obliquity than it is by precession at present. And it looks like temperatures could be following the obliquity cycle. Hmm. And remember that, of course, we are coming towards the end of our interglacial period. So we should, at some point, be falling back into another ice age. And that graph and some other graphs gives us the idea that we may fall into an ice age within the next 1,000 or 2,000 years or so.
Mm.
And again, that's not mentioned either. How do I get out of this full screen business?
Press that little plus symbol on your Skype and then go stop sharing screen.
Yeah, no, I need to get out of...
Oh, you mean that thing? Oh, just press that green button in the top corner again of the picture.
Green button has disappeared.
It'll come back if you just hover it in the top left hand corner. Or press escape.
Yeah, I'm pressing escape and nothing is happening. I've got full screen on permanent at present.
That is an oddity and a pain in the ass. One moment, please.
It is.
Okay, so in the top right-hand corner there. Oh, my God. There we go. No. Have you got a F3 key?
I've come back to nothing at present. Okay, yeah, I seem to have done something.
Yeah, there we go. And now you should be able to comment on that. So F3 shows you all your panels and everything and just opens it up like that. So
that's because Mail quit. Oh, that's why it wouldn't go back to normal. So Mail has quit.
She might be a bit hot.
Yeah. I'm afraid she is, overworking it.
Yep. All right, well, in that case, you can just flick your webcam on, unless, of course, there's still yet more imagery.
No, I can do some... It's all on a bit of a go slow at present. Hold on. Mm-hmm. Share screen. Here we go. Right, so we're back again. I didn't mean to do that. Ah, there's my green button.
Yeah.
Right, now I've managed to reduce it back down to normal. Okay, so where did we get to? We got to
the Holocene.
Things that they are not telling us about.
Mm.
And the Holocene maximum was one of them, because we've not been told about the full facts about the Holocene maximum.
You're still sharing screen, by the way, so when's the grab up the next image? Unless, of course, you want to turn that off. So sorry about this, folks. Oh, and by the way, I'd like to just take this opportunity to... something I realized in my show a couple of days ago, folks, is I don't actually take time out during the show to actually express my gratitude for you guys watching and donating and sharing all of this stuff and giving the channel likes and subscribing. And there's so many things that my audience does for me. And there's only really one thing I do for my audience, and that's produce the show. And to my mind, that means I'm kind of in your debt a lot of the time, ladies and gentlemen. I actually feel guilty that you give me support, and all I'm doing is giving you entertainment. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if you understand the concept of what it is to feel guilty for doing the right thing, but that's how I feel all the time. I find that guilt is much easier replaced with gratitude. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. That's all I wanted to say. Go ahead, Ralph.
I'm struggling here with Mail at present.
You may have a lot of other little windows and programs and things like that open that are minimized, and if you close them all out, that should significantly decrease the amount of strain on your computer. Also, for those of you who are Mac users, I will just show you on the screen now. There's this little program up here called SMC Fan Control, and you see how the fan speeds up here are up absolutely full. And what's good about that is that if you're working and you've got something really, really intense for your computer to do, live streaming, for example, is incredibly intense on a computer, you can just turn your fans all the way up, and so your computer will stay cool and not freeze. And that's a free program, SMC Fan Control, shown to me by a Russian computer expert who's no longer with us anymore. So
that's sad.
It is.
I've managed to get Mail up again, so we're up and running again. And what I was going to show you, if I can do it without crashing the computer again, let's try a different... I won't use that other way of expanding the screen. Let's see if I can share screen again. If you can hover it. Is that sharing?
Yeah, absolutely.
See. Okay, the graph we've got here is Northern Hemisphere autumn snow extent, last 50 years. Because, as you know, we've been told time and time again, with global warming, it's going to prevent any snow. And we
also
have this,
bear in mind, if you've got to full screen those graphs as well, so the audience can see them a bit clearer. Just the little green
full screen.
Oh, the little green button at the top, I mean. Or if you actually press Command and then
probably crash it again.
If you press Command plus,
yeah,
hold Command and then press the plus key, it should actually expand the size of the mail images.
Not to mail, it doesn't now.
You're holding Command and pressing plus?
Yeah, it does in other programs, but not in mail, obviously.
Oh, well, no worries.
These are limited. These are JPEGs that are limited by size. The only thing I could do maybe is if I tap on these, I could probably get a preview.
Yeah, that's good.
How about
That's much bigger. So what I'm doing on in the background here is I'm expanding the size of those things for the audience as well. So that looks great. Cool.
Okay. So this is on preview. And, yeah, back in year 2000, we had one of our senior climate scientists in the UK saying that because of global warming, the climate is warming, and our children will not know what snow is. And here is the Northern Hemisphere snow extent for the autumn. And as you can see, snow extent has been climbing, it's been rising for the last 60 years.
Wow.
50 years. Now, again, this climate scientist must have known this because he's a climate scientist, for goodness sake. And he said this back in 2001. And even if you go 2001, which is about here-ish, it was quite obvious that the autumn snow extent was increasing, not decreasing.
Mm. I was just thinking the term climate scientist was sort of a contradiction, but...
Yeah, it's a bit of an oxymoron, really, isn't it? You know.
Well, I'm not sure how much oxy there is, but there's certainly morons.
they used to be considered the same as humanities, you know, not proper scientists at all.
Mm.
But now they are the main drivers, and this is one of the reasons we get this. Nowadays, they are one of the main drivers of income for the universities. You know, so the climate department, which used to be in the bicycle shed down the end of the alleyway somewhere, is now the largest department in the university. And this is what's happened. This is one of the results of this climate alarmism, is it's generated an awful lot of money.
Yeah, that's another thing as well. What was his name? Mark Twain, he said, a human being will not understand something if his income depends on him not understanding it.
Yeah, which is very true. Very true indeed. And
like, for instance, I can't understand advertising. I understand donations, but
well, as long as the donations still keep coming in, you're okay.
No one can only hope.
This is the winter snow extent. So even if we take the whole of the winter, the snow extent has been gently increasing for the last 50 years.
Mm.
And again, climate scientists should have known about this before they made their pronouncements, and they're continuing to make their pronouncements sometimes. Although recently, because we've had some snowy winters up in the north, they're now saying that snow was predicted by global warming. But of course, at the time, back in 2000, you know, 20 years ago, they did not predict more snow at all. They were saying completely the reverse. So they've just changed their tune, basically, based upon what's happening. It's like, you know, heads we win, tails you lose. Whatever.
Well, it's called making shit up. All right. So if you if you are a liar and the facts don't suit your lies, and you know this, of course, because you're a liar to fucking begin with, you just deny that the facts exist in the first place and just make shit up. All right. So, I never said that. Yes, you did. Here's a recording of you saying it. Oh, my. Just deny. Oh, my God. It's frustrating dealing with these people for one particular reason. And that reason being reason itself. You know, are you able to reason? No, we're not. We're climate scientists. Reason isn't part of our shtick. Oh, fuck me sideways. We're all going to die. Okay, so if you continue on there, Ralph.
Yeah, I'm just trying to work out my preview. I'm not very good at doing this. We should have had these.
No, don't worry. I've done everything on this end. So as soon as you put your preview up, it's full screen for the live streaming audience.
Okay, right. It keeps coming up on a different tab to the one I'm expecting. I tried to change it, but it wouldn't. The next one we want to look at is sea ice, because, you know, they say that sea ice is melting. I mean, that's one of the big scare stories, that the sea ice is reducing. And the polar bear is going to die, you know. This is one of the big horror stories that they've been selling for the last 20, 30 years.
The world's best land swimmers can swim 200 miles without food or water. That's a polar bear. And you think, oh, they're going to drown if there's not enough ice. Really, cunt? Really?
Yeah, they are some of the best swimmers out there, apart from fish, really.
Yeah, they are the best land swimmer, you know. Because they have to swim around. They live on ice, surrounded by water. You'd figure they'd evolve to be really good swimmers, but not according to climate science, because climate science doesn't include this thing called biology!
Well, it does include the science of making stuff up. I mean, they do that quite a lot. All these, they came out recently with all of these images of starving polar bears, as if polar bears never grow old and die. So they managed to get this image of an old polar bear that was on its last legs, and they were trying to sell this as all the polar bears were dying. But of course, what they won't tell you, and again, we're coming back to this being economical with the truth again, what they won't tell you is that polar bear numbers have increased from the 1960s, from about 6,000, they say, polar bears, to 36,000 now.
Yeah.
So rather than polar bears dying out, they've increased hugely.
They've become a plague.
Yeah, they've become a plague. Over the last 50 years, they've grown immensely. Now, some of that was due to the fact that they banned hunting, and that obviously helped the polar bears. But nevertheless, their numbers have increased substantially, despite whatever is happening to the sea ice. But what they say about sea ice is that the sea ice is melting. And we had this prediction, I think it was by 2015, there would be no more summer sea ice in the Arctic. But of course, we know that was another one. This is another thing, you know, all of their predictions are wrong, yet people still believe them as being the oracles of climate.
I think that's a narcissistic abuse syndrome. Oh, no. Hey, I know he's lied to me my entire relationship, and every single time he said he wouldn't do it, he still did it again. But I'm just going to give him one more chance after the other million chances that I gave him. I'm sure he'll change if I don't do anything to change his behavior. You know, oh, my God, there's no reasoning process there.
Indeed. And this is a picture of sea ice. And look what's happening to the sea ice.
Yeah.
It's increasing. Now, do you see what I've done there?
Yeah.
If you look at the top here, it says Antarctic.
Yeah.
So this is not the Arctic. This is the Antarctic. But nevertheless, why will they not say that Antarctic ice has been growing? This is since 1978. So this we're talking more than 30 years here. Antarctic sea ice has been growing for more than 30 years. But why is that not on the newspapers and on the BBC and CNN as much as all of this Arctic sea ice disappearing is?
Because it doesn't fit their bullshit narrative that they make billions off? Just taking a stab in the dark.
Stab in the dark, yeah.
It does narrative. They keep on, you know.
They won't tell you about it. And Antarctic sea ice, this is the real data, has been increasing for the last 35 years. Now, there has been a glitch. The next graph is the both poles. So this is both poles. And if you can see that the red is the Antarctic, and that's been increasing for 35 years. And the blue is the Arctic. So that's the one they concentrate on because that's been decreasing. That fits the narrative. And so they keep telling me about that one. But have a look at the red one. It's been going up for 35 years. Okay, it took a dive in 2016-17, which was mainly caused by heavy storms. It wasn't caused by temperature. It was caused by heavy storms, which broke up the ice around Antarctica. And we had this big drop. But it's been rising ever since, and we'll see how much it goes back up to how it used to be.
Mm. But well, this it's is interesting. Just the, multivariate analysis would reveal a lot of interesting aspects of this, you know, because if you're just going on one thing, like CO2, like you're looking through this tiny little keyhole, and that's the only thing you can freaking see, and so naturally you can't see much, and so everything you do, you just jump to conclusions. Oh yeah, that fits our narrative. That does. Yeah. We'll tell people about that. Well, this one over here, no, that doesn't fit the narrative. Fuck it, doesn't exist.
Yeah, and that is the problem. That is what they've been doing. They've been concentrating on one element to the exclusion of everything else. And here's another one. They have been talking about tornadoes. So we get all of these reports of these terrible tornadoes running across America, and they're destroying everything, and they're getting worse. They're being made worse by... Well, they call it climate change now, don't they? They're not allowed to call it global warming anymore.
They weren't allowed to call it global cooling before they started calling it global warming. And what happens if it changes in ways that we don't think? Well, just call it climate change. Oh, my God, that's brilliant.
It's exactly what they did. They ran out of warming, and so they had to find a different name for it. So they called it climate change instead.
Yeah, it's a basic scamming technique. If people understand that snake oil is a scam, no, this one's primate oil.
Change the title and you're away.
Yeah, because then people have to realize that there's a new scam afoot. And by the time you expose that, change the name again. It won't be climate change or anything like that in the future. It'll be something else. Goodness knows what they'll choose this time, but I'm sure it'll fit just nicely.
They'll find something, yeah. But what they've been saying is that tornadoes are getting worse because of climate change, global warming, whatever they want to call it. And that's what we've been told on the media. But this is the graph. So here we go. This is tornadoes over the last tour. What's that? That's 65 years. From 1955, that is, 54, up until now. So that's 46, 56. Yeah, over 60 years. And what's been happening? They've been decreasing. These are strong tornadoes, so this is F3 plus up to F5. And since 1954, the number of strong tornadoes has been decreasing. And if you look in the right-hand corner down here where it says 2018 was the lowest in history, never recorded so low as 2018. Now, is that the impression that we're given? No. On the media. And okay, the media have got it wrong. Do the climate scientists correct them and tell them, no, you've got it wrong, actually the number of strong tornadoes is going down, please broadcast that in your next program? Do we get that from climate scientists? No, we don't.
Oh, if I may, they might be, but what I found in this show, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, I've said things on this show that I've stated as absolute truth, then later on somebody's actually listened back to it and then shown me a source that has proven me wrong. Now, 1,000 people will listen to the wrong statement that I made, but only maybe 100 people will get a chance to hear the retraction. So if 90% of people only heard the lie and only 10% of people heard the truth, the lie becomes the mainstream narrative and people will think that that's true even though it's not, even though it's been retracted, because when things go out for the first time, that's where the audience is. I mean, let's think about this. For example, if I did a show, ladies and gentlemen, let's say it was with Ralph Ellis, and they say, we're going to tell you some new stories about climate change and all of that kind of stuff. Interesting, right? You'd want to come here. But if I did a show called All the Things I've Been Wrong About during the Last Show, not quite as interesting, is it? And your attention won't want to go and correct yourself on things that you've gotten wrong or that I've gotten wrong, because people just don't like being wrong, full stop, let alone listening to somebody else saying, I was wrong about this, I was wrong about that. It's boring.
And they'll put it on page 16.
Oh, yeah.
So the original story will be front page headline news, enormous great letters, and the retraction will be on page 16. It'll be about 3 centimeters high, in the smallest type they have available.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they do. Same as BBC. The BBC makes retractions, and I've seen them, actually. The BBC does make retractions, and it normally makes them at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. I try to make my retractions pretty much as prominent as I possibly can, but even then, you know, I kind of get pissed off at myself, actually, because I realize that I'm not a credible journalist. I'm an incredible journalist. But anyway, we're coming
on. You're not the Pope. You're not infallible.
Yeah. Well, neither is he. but he is, I don't know. He's unjailable, unarrestable, you know, unassailable.
Yeah,
you know, hey, how many children have you raped today? Oh, only like 18. Oh, okay. A slow day, eh? Yeah. Am I joking about pedophilia? I've reached a new low. I've reached a new level.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
The Pope. Yeah.
Go ahead. Tornadoes was a topic.
Yeah, that's what yes. So we are not being told the truth about tornadoes. And you'll show this wonderful graph here to believers, and they'll deny it. They say it's not true. But this data, this comes from NOAA. This is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in America. This is the this is the body that holds all of the data. This is the basic climate data that you'll get. And it's telling us something that they will not tell us in the media, that as CO2 has risen, the number of strong to violent tornadoes has decreased. As temperatures have increased, strong to violent tornadoes have decreased. The complete opposite of what they forecast and what they have said. And if there's a basic premise in science that if the results of your theory or the results of your experiment do not agree with nature, with the real world, it's your experiment that's wrong. It's your theory that's wrong. It's not the real world that's wrong. You're wrong. And so if climate scientists are wrong about this, they are wrong. And they've been wrong on so many occasions. What else that they are telling us is actually wrong?
It reminds me
of
reminds me of another Mark Twain quote, is that when a man discovers the truth that he is wrong, he will either cease to be wrong or cease to be honest.
Yeah, well, I think the latter. Because they have a history of doing this, because we have another one. They have this, you know, global warming is warming the oceans and it's causing enormous great hurricanes and typhoons, and they're all getting worse and they're all going to travel across the oceans and they could destroy us all, you know. But here is the data. This is the hurricane frequency since 1980. And what do we have? Well, all hurricanes on the top, the number of all hurricanes is decreasing. And the number of major hurricanes is almost pretty much steady. This is the major ones down the bottom in the green here. They are steady. They're not moving at all. So the number of tropical cyclones, hurricanes and typhoons is not increasing at all. And this is the real data. This is the data by Ryan Moe, who's he was based in Hawaii for a long time, I think. And he used to keep all of the records of the tropical cyclones. So, again, the prediction was more warming is must mean more tropical cyclones. But it doesn't. Quite the reverse is happening. And even more so if we look at the total energy, because then, you know, people will immediately say, oh, that's just the number of cyclones, but they must be getting stronger. Well, not exactly, because this is the graph. This is the graph for hurricane energy, total energy of all hurricanes across all over the oceans. And he calls it here global tropical cyclone accumulated cyclone energy. Well, there we go. So the total energy of all cyclones was going up from 1970. This is even earlier, this one, up until 1994, roughly 93. And then it's been decreasing since then. And this goes all the way up until 2018, this particular graph. So the number of strong tropical cyclones has been decreasing. More than that, because people keep saying, oh, they're devastating. Look at all the damage they've done to, you know, East Coast America. America had the longest ever period without a landfall hurricane. After Katrina, they didn't have a landfall hurricane for 11 years. That's the longest period ever in recorded history.
Wow.
And you say this to people and you say, no, that's not true. It's not true. And, sorry, this is the NOAA data. And they keep all the data. And it was the longest period ever without a landfall hurricane. And again, when we had that last one, I forget what the last one was called, the one that tracked across Florida somewhere. Oh, it went up into Texas, didn't it? And caused a lot of flooding. And immediately the BBC... I'm going to have to cough here. That's the one. Yeah, cover me up. Immediately, the BBC was saying, oh, look, you know, hurricanes are getting worse. Look at all this devastation. Well, note, before that one was the longest ever period without a hurricane in American history. But the BBC didn't mention that. So, again, economical with the truth, telling us lies by omission, I like to say this. They're not actually lying, but they're just not telling us the truth.
I think dishonesty qualifies as both telling blatant lies and omitting incredibly important truth. So
you would have thought so.
That's the thing as well. Dishonesty is dishonesty does.
Yes. And here is another one. This is the dishonesty that started the whole of the thing in the first place. This is the hockey sticks graph that was promoted by Al Gore. And there was a problem with this because it was dishonest in two or more fashions. So here we have a graph of temperature from the last 1,000 years. This goes back to 1000 AD. And it runs across here all the way to the bottom. And then the temperature shoots up. Look at that. Must be global warming. Must be CO2, surely. I mean, look at it. But this was an outright lie. Because what happened is, this is tree ring data. And we'll have a look at tree rings in a minute. This is all tree ring data down here. And the graph actually went down. It went down here somewhere. It said it was colder. So they got a big eraser. We call them rubbers over here, but you're not allowed to call them over here in America. You have to call them erasers in America.
Because it means something different, yeah. There's a little cultural idiosyncrasies. Well.
But yeah, in Britain we call them rubbers and you get into trouble with that. Anyway, you get your eraser and you erase this section down here because that's inconvenient truth. And then what they did is they spliced on this red bit, and this red bit is the thermometer data from real thermometers. Well, hold on a minute. A, you're not supposed to splice in two graphs together and not tell us. B, they're two entirely different methods of recording temperature. And C, if tree rings were saying that temperatures were declining, and so tree rings were not agreeing with the temperature record from thermometers, that means tree ring data is incorrect. So why have we got all of this over here if we've just proven that tree rings don't record temperature very well? This over here is a load of rubbish.
Well, or in the scientific circles, it's known as a tree ring circus.
The tree ring circus, yeah. Well, it really is the way they presented it. So this graph has been it's been withdrawn, you might say. The IPCC no longer uses this graph. It's been withdrawn because it had a number of problems with it. They had this decline, as I say, and the decline was quite steep. And so what they did was, you know, it was made up of many trees from different areas, and they gave different weightings to different trees. And they gave so much weighting to one particular tree. This tree was called Yad-061. It was on the Siberian Peninsula at Yamal, way over in the east of Siberia, that the whole of the temperature record depended on this one tree. And it depended on this one tree because it was the only tree that showed any warming. So that's why they used it. And this was... This was called the Hide the Decline. You might have remembered from the ClimateGate emails. And they had this thing about, we're hiding the decline. And then we found Michael's trick or something. Well, Michael's trick was this, deleting the tree ring record and splicing in the temperature data from thermometers instead. So... yeah, this was the graph that started all of this global warming business. You remember Al Gore on his cherry picker that had to go way up on his cherry picker to go and find the top of the graph. You know, it was about 20 feet off the ground.
I think he was using occult symbolism in that. I mean, he used a cherry picker to go upwards for his cherry-picked data. Like, he was trying to tell you in his presentation in a subtle way.
that there's something wrong with this. Yeah, I'm using a cherry picker to cherry pick the data.
You can't make this shit up, folks. You just can't make it up. Oh my god.
But I've got serious doubts with all of this tree ring anyway, because the basic problem is: do tree rings show temperature? So the idea is that they take cores through these trees. So they get this corer, and it's only about a centimeter wide. And they take a core through the tree, and it gives you all these tree rings. And then you go and count them, and you measure the distance and how big they are. And that tells you what the temperature is. But have a look at this tree ring. So we've got a, this is actually a tree stump. So we've taken a slice through the tree. Now, where the yellow marker is, that's the set of tree rings. And you see they're very, very small. So that was very cold over in this sort of 3 o'clock position here. Now, if you follow those tree rings around, all the way around to the 12 o'clock position, now those tree rings are quite large. So it must have been warm. So this tree is telling you quite clearly that the weather was cold warm or warm cold. I mean, what was the weather? We've got no idea. It depends where you take your core. So if you took your core through here, you would say, oh, it was cold then. And so you'll put a nice cold patch in your temperature record for whenever this was, you know, 100 years ago or something. And if you took your core through this way from the north, from the 12 o'clock position, you'd say, oh, it's warm, and you put a warm section in your temperature record. So what are these tree rings actually telling us? I've discussed this on many occasions on many blogs. I've never got never got a serious answer as to what these tree rings are supposed to be recording, because what affects the
the
growth of a tree?
I just theory just popped into my head. Wind prevalence, you know, like the wind happened to be prevalent on that on the northern side or whatever, and hence the wind chill, and it'll deform it on that side rather than the other.
Indeed, that actually happens. You see that sometimes, especially if a tree is leaning over, it will grow on one side more than the other, and you'll get a big disparity in its tree ring growth. But, you know, trees from the very beginning, they are affected by pests. You get a sick tree, it'll have small rings. By canopy cover, if it's got bigger trees next door, it'll have very, very small rings because it can't grow very fast. And then when the big tree falls over, it suddenly grows faster. Now, does that mean it's got warmer, or does it mean that the tree next door has fallen over?
Yeah. How many variables are there? How many factors, you know?
Yeah. The main one, of course, is water. If you starve a tree of water, it won't grow. Mm. But it could be very, very hot. I mean, how many trees grow across the Nullarbor in Australia? It's very hot there, so they must have very big trees, surely. I presume you're familiar with the Nullarbor, are you?
No, not at all, because I live in New Zealand.
Oh. Well, I mean, it's only across the road from you.
If you say so. I mean, Russia, I mean, Scandinavia is only across the road from you, if that's the case.
Well, I've been across the Nullarbor. I'm one of the few idiots that decided to hitchhike across the Nullarbor.
Yeah. Well, I was very lucky in having cannabis convictions for selling cannabis, which means no government will ever let me in, unless I have a diplomatic passport of some description, so I can take my weed with me. Now, that's how it works.
You could travel in the diplomatic bag. You'd be all right.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Nullarbor is a huge desert in Australia. It's about 3,000 kilometers across or something. And so it's vast, but not a single thing grows there. It's totally barren from end to end. But it's hot. It should be full of big trees because it's hot. I mean, trees grow in hot weather, don't they? Well, no, they grow in warm and wet weather. That's what they like. And so tree rings are not really showing us temperature. They are showing us moisture more than anything else.
Mm.
And so the whole idea of this previous graph we saw that tried to show the temperature for the last 1,000 years is a complete nonsense. It doesn't show temperature at all. And yet that was used as the very basis of the climate scare.
Mm.
And of course, if you don't go along with this climate scare, you get this. This was David Bellamy. He was the UK's favorite ecologist, botanist, whatever. He was a scientist, used to be on television all the time. But very rashly, back in, I think it was 2004, it says here, I've got it, yeah. In 2004, he said that global warming was poppycock. And he disappeared. He was never seen again. We thought he'd been shuffled off to the gulags in Russia because he just disappeared. Why? Because the BBC got rid of him. Because he said that he didn't believe in global warming. And that's the problem with this, because, you know, they keep on about this 97% of scientists. But if you don't agree with it, your job is in jeopardy. If, you know, this is part of your job, if you're in the sort of climate science part of academia, your job depends on this.
Does that mean, therefore, that only 3% of the climatological community have scientific integrity?
Yeah, well, yes. No, what it means is the person that did this paper, they did this scientific paper on the number of people who agree with global warming. And they reviewed something like 11,000 papers. But when they checked the timestamps, they found that some of the reviewers were reviewing 100 papers an hour sort of thing, you know. And what they did is they said anyone who didn't come out against global warming was included in the ones who approved. But when they went through it later on and actually checked the number of scientists who were actually physically openly agreeing with global warming, it came out to 0.03% actually agreed with global warming, and the rest of them didn't. They didn't have an opinion, you know. They either said they didn't agree or they had no opinion. So the entire 97% was completely flawed. It was one of the most flawed science papers ever created.
Can here's the other thing as well. When people say it's flawed or it's incorrect or they were wrong or something like that, no offense. Because I hear these kind of things about these people whatsoever. Are we just trying to be nice when we say those things, you know? Or these people are fraudsters. These people are liars. These people are psychopaths. Because those are the words I'd use to describe this kind of hokum.
No, I don't sort of agree with it in that, quite in that fashion, because I take this to be the same as a religion. It's more of a bandwagon than a conspiracy. When you go to join a religion, you're not part of a conspiracy. You're not being paid to do so. You actually pay the religion to go and join them. You join them because you think this is the right thing to do, because it's the nice thing to do, it's the good thing to do. You're joining a bandwagon, and the bandwagon of global warming is a bandwagon of virtue. You are the good. Anyone who's against, you're saving the earth. You're saving all of the animals, especially the cuddly ones. Therefore, you're a good person. And anyone who's against it, they've got to be evil, aren't they? They've got to be bad people. And so I view this as a bandwagon of virtue. And the bandwagon is free. Anyone can jump on it. You're not coerced. No one's paying you to jump on it. Anyone can jump on this bandwagon. But once you're on that bandwagon, it's the same as a religion. Okay, you join Christianity. Let's go for something a little bit more obscure. Let's join the Church of Scientology. Now, that's a really good one to join. And you've joined this church, and it's complete rubbish from beginning to end, of course. If you've ever studied Scientology, you know what rubbish it is. But you've joined this club, and now you've got to defend it. So if someone criticizes it, you've got to defend it because it's your club. And so you've got to make up stories or reinforce stories that have been told about this particular religion, this bandwagon, in order to justify why you're a part of this bandwagon. Otherwise people would just take the mickey out of you. Why on earth have you joined this stupid religion? It's because, it's not stupid really. It's got this, it's got that. And so you start justifying it. And that's what the people on the climate bandwagon have done. They've started justifying their position.
Well, it's precisely as I mentioned before with cognitive dissonance. Even if you're wrong, still insist that you're right, no matter how wrong you are. You've actually made a really interesting point there as well, because it's a cult religion, and essentially, if you're a cultist, your upper thinking faculties are fucking gone. All right, they're just not there anymore. Reason is the ability to say, yes, I'm wrong. Okay, now I'm going to learn something. Okay, cult belief is, no, I'm not wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong. Why is that? Because you're wrong. It's circular reasoning because it's circular reasoning. And it's, you're wrong. You can't reason with those who have abandoned reason. Pretty, you wouldn't have seen that coming, but apparently it happens to people. Hey, there's this thing called reason. What did it give us? Everything we've ever built or achieved? Oh, okay. Well, let's fucking abandon it. Why abandon it? Oh, this guy said so. But the thing is, if you got reason in the first place, you wouldn't believe the person, would you? Theoretically, however, corrupting reason is a skill. All right, to get people to override reason with emotion. Won't somebody please think of the children by giving them mercury-containing vaccines, which is the second most potent neurotoxin in the world? Okay, not a whole lot of reason there. And yet, because you say, please think of the children, it bypasses that part of the brain. It goes straight past the frontal cortex, which processes logic and reason, which primates have and mammals don't. And it goes straight to the mammalian brain. That's the thing that governs our social awareness and our family units and all of that kind of thing. You can see that's why even cats and dogs and things like that, they have packs and tribes and blah, 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 blah. They have this awareness, but they don't have logic and reason. And if you are capable of hijacking that mammalian brain in somebody like that, you can bypass the primate brain and the reason part of it. And you can turn somebody essentially into an animal. And what happens when you corner an animal? They get really angry with you, don't they? And they and they puff themselves up and they start launching themselves at you. This is how you turn a human being into cattle, ladies and gentlemen. And it has happened to all of us at one point or another, I think.
Yeah, it's called the red mist. Yeah, I had this recently on my YouTube channel. So I've got this YouTube channel going with all of these YouTube videos going on it. The Ralph Ellis site. I think it's showing up on Google now. It didn't used to show before because it was so small. And this lady came on and I said, look, hold on a minute. You know, the world did not... what did she say? She said, yeah, exactly what you said. She said, I'm a part of the climate movement because I'm saving the world for my children. Yeah, thank you. But... the world didn't end 9,000 years ago when it was 2 degrees warmer than now during the Holocene maximum. Ah, yes, but that doesn't count. Yeah, okay. And then she said, you know nothing about this. And I said, well, I've written a science paper on paleoclimatology. What have you done? And so it goes on. But I know nothing, of course. But there you go.
I get similar arguments online and they go, Vinny, what have you done? Done about 10,000 hours of interviews with scientists, political figures and people from alphabet agencies and things like that from multiple different countries around the world. Oh, but that doesn't count because they weren't in New Zealand, apart from the 1,000 New Zealand activists that I've interviewed and things of that nature, including our parliamentarians and former police and so on and so on. But you're wrong, for fuck's sake.
Well, I don't mind people saying I'm wrong, but give me some data. The trouble is, as you were saying before, it's just the red mist and they just shout. If you have an argument, if you have a reason why I'm wrong, then give me the data, give me the argument, and I'll look at it.
You just quoted word for word what I just told somebody like the other day.
But they don't. They just shout and say, you're wrong. Just like you were saying. But you say it better than I do. But anyway, that's what they say. You're wrong.
Yeah. I'm in touch with my rage. That's why I say it better. Anyway, go ahead.
And so I just carry on and I keep giving them the data. And this is the data they like to give them. Oh, I wasn't going to look at that one first. I was going to look at this one first. I was going to look at this one because they make... Oh, no. Shall we look at that one first? Because they make these models. This is... a graph of all the models they make. So these scientists, they make these wonderful models and they say, look, here's proof of global warming because I've made a model. I said, well, yeah, no, that's actually a model. That's not proof.
Yeah, it's like, hey, here's proof of a battleship. I made a model.
And, you know, there's so many reasons why a model might not work. You have GIGO, you have garbage in, garbage out. So if you put rubbish in, you'll get a rubbish result. You have programmer bias. And so if you program, if you tune your your modeling correctly, you're not going to get the right information. If you put the wrong inputs into it, you're not going to get the right information. And this is a result of what they've made. So the red line is the average of 102 models that have been made of future climate. And down the bottom here, we have the blue and the green. That's the satellite record of temperatures. And of course, the real world does not agree with the forecast. So the models are wrong. And again, we come back to this fundamental thing of science that if the real world disagrees with your model, it's your model that's wrong, not the real world. So go back to your model and try again, you know, because you got it wrong. And, you know, they'll say, but yeah, we've made these wonderful models, but anyone can make a model. Here is one that I like by Willis Eschenbach. He's a mathematician. He's not a climate scientist, but he's rather good at mathematics. And he's a skeptic like you and like me and like many others.
Like every scientist?
Yeah, like
technically, they're all skeptics, because if you're not a skeptic, you're not into science.
You're not a scientist. That is a fundamental of science. It's true.
I repeat, so, for fuck's sake.
So what he did is he made his own model. And here's his model. So the black here is temperatures. This is real world temperatures from Hadkrut, which is one of the established temperature records. And the output in red is his model. And look at that. It's perfect.
Boom.
It's absolutely perfect. But of course, it's completely bogus. Because he just chose two data sets at random and tuned them until they fitted.
Yeah.
Which just goes to show that if you tune your model far enough, you can make anything fit the temperature record, because this diagram is completely bogus.
Wow.
What did he choose? He chose snow albedo and orbital variations. And he just threw them together into a model, and it fits. So the fact that you've got a model and the model sort of vaguely represents temperature does not mean that you can forecast future temperatures.
It's no link to causality.
No, and you might be using the wrong inputs into it in the first place. And we'll go through this in a minute, because I think that most climate scientists are using the wrong input. And another thing we have with models is this one. This is the adjustments that they have made. So when the raw data comes in from all of these reporting centers all over the world, from each of these, you know, temperature recording stations, there are thousands of them across the world, you get all these temperatures come in. But each one has to be adjusted. And they're adjusted for many reasons. They're adjusted for time of day. They're adjusted because you've moved the station, maybe it's moved, you know, 5 or 6 meters to another location. So they change the temperatures that are coming out of it. Or why else? Oh, they've adjusted them for urban heat island and various other. Oh, and because they've changed the thermometers. They used to be all glass thermometers. Now they're all sort of digital. And so they had to make changes to all the temperatures. And these are the changes they made to all of the temperatures. And as you can see, all the changes in the past, this goes back to the 19th century here, 1880 over here. So we've got 130 years of temperatures here. In the past, they made all the temperatures colder. And in the modern era, they made them all warmer. So if you just got these adjustments and plotted them on the graph, you would get this. So let's say, just for instance, that the temperature has never changed in the world for the last 130 years. Well, that never change is the green plot along the bottom. So the temperatures have never changed. But now we've got to adjust those temperatures because, you've moved your station, we've changed onto a digital thermometer. So we've got to adjust all of those temperatures. And this is the result, which is the red graph. Oh, look, temperatures have warmed in recent years. Well, no, they haven't. You just adjusted all the data. The temperature hasn't warmed at all. So half of the temperature adjustments, sorry, half of the temperature rise you see when they show you these temperature rises on these graphs, half of that temperature rise has been caused by adjustments, not by temperature rise.
That's interesting. I think Great Global Warming Swindle talked about the measuring devices that they were using in Canada. There are approximately 700 of them, and 697 of them started recording colder temperatures. So they shut all of those down, and now they've only got three, and all of which happened to be at like airports or on tarmacs or somewhere that was really hot as hell or something like that. And they go, see, it's warming.
Well, that is very true. They did the same with the TAO buoys. They set these buoys out floating across the oceans. And there were some of them which were recording much too cold temperatures. And so all those ones were deleted. That big purge of the measuring stations is a well-known event. It happened, I think, in the 80s or 90s, and it's called the great dying, I think they call it, of the temperature stations, because like 75% of the stations were all knocked off. And yes, they never really came up with a good explanation as to why that happened. But you're quite right. It did happen.
Well, it's, I mean, that's assuming that fraud isn't a good reason.
Well, yeah. If you're being paid to... if you're being paid to find warming, then it's a very good reason for doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody made a point to me the other day, you can't convince people of things by force. And I go, really? Imagine I'm a Roman centurion and I have a spear to your face. And I say, accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior, or you're dead. And they go, oh, okay, I accept Jesus as my Lord and Savior. You're saved. See, I just fucking convinced you, didn't I?
And it happens, and it happens financially as well. You know, if you get the David Bellamy's of this world, you know, I don't believe in global warming. Okay, you're dismissed.
And interestingly enough, once that happens, it has a chilling effect. You know, not to be too punny about
especially
it.
Especially on his family, because, you know, you lose your house, you lose your wife, you lose your kids, you know, all because you said, I don't believe in global warming. So, you know, you've got a clear choice.
The global warming chilling effect. Isn't that interesting? Didn't see that coming. On to the next data.
Yeah, this is a good graph. This is the central England temperature. And this comes back to something you've just been talking about. So I will come on to exactly what you've said. This is the central England temperature, which is the longest temperature data set in the world. And as you see here, it goes back to 1659. It's more than 400 years old. And here we go. We had the Little Ice Age, and then it wobbles around. And it wobbles around. And then, look, from 1980, zipperoonie, it goes up nearly 1 degree. That's global warming, you know? You can see. And it was caused by CO2, because CO2 went up as well. I mean, what else, what other explanation could you have for this sudden rise since 1980 in central England temperature? Well, there is another possible reason for why it went up. And it's to do with the locations that the recording station was at. So the CET is formed from four stations. And one of the stations was... here. You might recognize that.
Is that Heathrow?
No, nearly. This is Manchester International Airport. Which is almost as busy as Heathrow. Not quite, but there we go. There's a nice red arrow pointing to where the station used to be. And this taxiway to the north was the main taxiway back to the terminal. Every aircraft landing at Manchester went along this taxiway.
So all the heat from their jet engines would pass that thing every single time they passed through that thing. Oh, okay.
From, you know, some pretty big aircraft. And this aircraft here, and you probably can't see that, but just here to the left of the arrow, there is an aircraft sitting in a bay. That is the jet engine test stand. Where they're running up.
Oh my god, that is fucking classic. Oh my god. Fuck, that's funny.
This is where they run up the engines to full power to see if they're working or not. But that's never going to affect the temperature.
For fuck's sake. Oh my god. Oh shit.
So, and of course, since 1970s, there has been an enormous expansion in the number of aircraft at Manchester Airport. I mean, there used to be one or two little turboprops going past. And now, you know, there was 777s and jumbo jets and God knows what running past there, all blowing their hot air onto the temperature sensor. And it wasn't until 2005 that they decided that this wasn't actually a very good measuring station.
So how long did it take them to figure that one out? Like 20 years, 30 years?
And if you look at the chart in 2005, the temperatures took a dive. So, you know, what are we measuring here? You know, do we have faith in the temperatures that we are using? Because, you know, we have this massive urbanization of our temperature sensors, because a lot of these temperature sensors are based in areas where there is lots of human habitation. And those cities have grown out around these temperature measuring stations. The airports have grown bigger, because a lot of them are on airports, because airports have to have a weather monitoring station by law. And so where are all your measuring stations going to be? Well, they're going to be on airports.
Wow.
So a lot of the temperature rise we've been measuring has just been measuring the increase in air travel over the last 30 years.
Wow.
And as you know, and as you said, air travel is increased by an enormous amount over the last 30 years. So, yeah, we're not even sure if we have any global warming.
Well, see, some lady talked to me one time, and she said, "You deny climate change." And I go, "No, it's been changing for 4 billion years."
The problem is, what is causing it?
Yeah,
we don't know. We don't know. And well, here's another one. We're talking about adjustments.
Well, there's some theories, like, for example, the giant furiously burning ball of superheated gas that provides us with almost all of our fucking weather. Maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe it's just like a tiny bit of the fucking cousin.
Yes. Well, here's another, just going back to the adjustments business. So this is not even, you know, the measuring, this is the adjusting. This is a satellite record. There are two satellite records. One is called UAH and the other is called RSS. This is the UAH satellite record. And this was originally taken to be the new great hope for temperature measuring, because this eliminated all of those horrible little measuring stations in airports. This was measured by satellite. It was brilliant. And so everyone said this was the way forward for temperature measurements. Until, of course, it didn't show any global warming. And then they dropped it like a hot potato. They've never used it since. They've gone back to using the surface record with thermometers. Anyway,
I also wonder, can digital thermometers be adjusted manually? So like for example, I'm overweight, okay? And I have an adjustable scale. And so if I adjusted to a certain level and stuff like that, and then weigh myself, I'd be like, ha ha, I lost over a kilo today. You know, that can you do that with the temperature devices like that?
That's how they're made, of course. When they're made, they are all different. And then you have to measure them against a against some sort of standard and tweak them to make sure that they all agree to the same standard.
Is it like a clock, how it gets fractions of a second out of time every now and again?
Nowadays, it's all digital, but nevertheless, there is a mechanical element in the actual measurement of the temperature. But you have to try and make sure that they all agree with each other. So when they come off the factory line, they all disagree, and then you have to tweak them to make sure they agree. But of course, when they're actually in use, they can start to drift off a little bit. And so someone has to go around every couple of years to tweak them back again to make sure they're all sort of agreeing with the set standard temperature.
And were to perhaps fudge on purpose that set standard temperature because you had a political agenda, what would the results fucking show you, you know?
Yes, well, this is listeners may laugh at that, but this is exactly what's happened.
See, so I'm just cynical like that, so that's why I get so much shit right without knowing nothing anymore about it.
So this is the UAH satellite record, and in 2012 they noticed that the satellite was actually decaying. Its orbit was getting lower and lower, and so it was misreading, and so they had to make an adjustment. And here you see the adjustment. So the red was the previous. Is it the red? Yeah, the red was the previous, and the blue is the adjusted. And you can hardly see the red because it's overprinted with the blue. So the adjustment was very, very small, hardly any adjustment at all. And so that was UAH. And then RSS did exactly the same. And that's their adjustment. So same adjustment for the same reason. And this was the original in red. And this is the blue. So we've just adjusted you up by nearly 0.2 of a degree centigrade,
which is gargantuan.
Just for no apparent reason. And the other satellite record didn't do it. Of course, what they've done here is they've tried to adjust this record to agree more with the surface record. But who says the surface record is correct? I mean, the surface record is only measuring the increase in the number of aircraft at Manchester Airport. It's not recording temperature at all. So they're readjusting their satellite to a surface record that is probably incorrect in the first place. And so do we trust these temperature records? I'm not sure that we do.
Well, it's who watches the watches comes to mind, that old phrase, who calibrates the calibrators.
Someone who you don't trust very much. Here we come on to global energy flows. I have a hunch that the whole idea of CO2 global warming is incorrect because of a basic scientific fact. This is the a graph of global energy flows in and out of the atmosphere. So this is the sunlight coming in, and the orange heats the surface, and then heat goes back out again as long-wave radiation, and it gets trapped by clouds, and it gets trapped by water vapor and CO2, and some of it comes back down to the earth again. That is the greenhouse effect. So on the right here, we see something called back radiation with an arrow going back down to the surface. That is global warming. That is the greenhouse effect. That is how you trap heat in the atmosphere, by it going up, being intercepted by, absorbed by water vapor and CO2, and sent back down to the earth again. That is the greenhouse effect. So if global warming is caused by increased greenhouse effect, you must have increasing back radiation, or DLR they call it, downwelling long wave radiation. This one here, can you see my little cursor going round and round?
Just yet.
Too small. On the right, it says 333. There's an arrow going downwards. It's called back radiation. That must be increasing if greenhouse warming is increasing. However, they have done some analysis and measurements of this back radiation. And here is the graph of back radiation, if I can expand it. And the trouble is that back radiation is not increasing. And that's a problem. Because if back radiation is not increasing, then there is no greenhouse warming. There is no increasing greenhouse warming.
Mm.
So the warming that we've had, if there has been any, it has not been caused by increased greenhouse warming, by CO2. Because otherwise these would increase. I know the scale is quite small. These are the divisions are 20 watts per square meter. But even so, these graphs should be increasing. And they are not. This is since year 2000. They should be increasing. And they're not increasing. Which rather disproves the whole of the global warming theory. The whole of the CO2-induced, greenhouse gases-induced global warming theory. Because otherwise, this back radiation has to increase, and it's not increasing. And I've put this little theory out on many occasions to many people, and I've had no
takers?
Responses. Nope. No rational reason for why that should be so.
You asked a cult to provide you a rational reason why something in their cult doesn't make sense, and yeah, nobody, and you didn't have any takers, hey? Fuck.
That was the wrong thing to do, really, wasn't it?
Oh my God.
So what I do is I then go through what else could be causing global warming. And one of the things could be sunspots. Now, the 11-year sunspot cycle doesn't seem to have changed temperature at all. But this long-term sunspot cycle, what they call grand minima, does seem to affect temperature. Because in the late 1600s, we had no sunspots, and the temperatures were cooler. So if we go back to the central England temperature, we see the, on the left side here, 1600s, we see the cool era. That was the little ice age.
That was when the Thames was freezing over.
That was when the Thames was freezing, and it coincided with a low sunspot number. And the thing is, we had in the modern era, in cycle 24, which was 2010 roughly, we had a very low sunspot number. And the forecast for cycle 25 is a low sunspot number as well. So it's possible that we are going back into some sort of grand minima again.
Well, the current temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere would suggest that that's not unlikely at all.
No. And considering the temperatures they're giving us are all adjusted figures and not real figures, it's quite possible that we are entering perhaps a cool phase.
Hmm.
And there's a number of reasons why that might happen. Sunspots might be one of them, because we might be entering a grand minima. We don't know. We'll have to see what happens to number 25. But another reason might be this one. This is the PDO oceanic cycle. So the oceans have their own little cycles. This is actually an atmospheric cycle over the Pacific Ocean. And it changes. And they just call it positive and negative, it doesn't really mean much. It's just the direction of the winds over the Pacific. And so we have these, this graph goes back to 1910. And we have these positive areas and then negative and then positive and then negative. And it just so happens that they sort of agree with recent temperatures. So if we look at this with temperatures as well, again, this is since 1900. So PDO index, this is the oceanic index, is on the bottom in the blue, and temperatures are in the red. And the PDO increased as temperatures increased in the 1930s. So 1930s, 1940s were quite warm. And then they began to cool. And they cooled at the same time that the PDO index went into negative. And then when PDO went into positive again, temperatures started to rise. Remember, we had that cool period around the 1970s when they said we were entering a new ice age. And so we had that cold period, and then it started warming again. And it seems to go roughly in line with the PDO oceanic cycle oscillation, which has about a 60, 65-year cycle to it. So are temperatures being influenced by oceanic cycles? Well, it's possible. If you look on warmest websites, they'll say, no, it's not, because they're just moving temperatures around the world. They're not actually changing temperatures. They're just sort of moving hot bits to cold bits and cold bits to hot bits. They're just spreading the temperature around the world a bit, so it's not changing global temperature. But if you move a hot piece of the atmosphere and move it up into the Arctic, A, you're going to make the Arctic warmer, and B, it's much easier for that energy to be dissipated into space, because it's nice and cool up there. It dissipates well back into space. So you can control global temperatures via oceanic cycles. And the only thing we're here is at present we're going into the negative. So we're going back into the negative oceanic cycle at present. And that sort of implies that temperatures will be cooling again. Now, they haven't cooled much at present, but then a lot of this temperature rise we've just seen is just recording the rise in air travel at Manchester Airport. It's not recording temperatures at all. So it is quite possible that we will be entering a cooler period because of oceanic cycles. And the final thing that can affect global temperature is albedo again. Going back to albedo, what we were talking about before with the ice age cycle, which is controlled by albedo, not by CO2. Because albedo can be quite strong, even annually.
Just ask my wife. Mine's ridiculous.
She gets very cold, does she?
No. If anything, it's the opposite. It just gets hot. But I jest. I do. Go ahead.
So in the winter, all of this will be covered in snow. So this is Canada down the bottom. All of Canada will be covered in snow. All at the top here on the left is Siberia. That'll all be covered in snow. Even northern Europe, that'll all be covered with snow. So all of this area you can see in this picture will be covered in snow. Now, during the spring, that is a huge cooling effect. All of this white snow and ice reflecting the sunlight, disappearing back off into space, so it's not warming the Earth. That has a big cooling effect. And so if we can have more snow, that's going to cool the planet. If we can get rid of that snow, it'll warm the planet. And as we saw before, winter snows were actually increasing, not decreasing. However, if we can make that snow darker, Like, for instance, if we take all of that dust and soot and shit from China and stick it all over the northern ice sheets, that's going to make the snow darker. And you'll end up with something like this. This is modern snow up in the Arctic. And as you can see, I think man has had an effect on that. The snow has turned black. It's called dark snow, and there are enormous great patches of this dark snow across the Arctic nowadays.
Yeah, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. On your Arctic expeditions, no smoking.
Yeah. This is what happens if you do. You turn the snow black. And, of course, if you turn the snow black, it's going to absorb more sunlight.
Mm. And then melt.
It's absorbing more sunlight. It's melting more. And it's putting more energy into the atmosphere because it's absorbing all of that sunlight.
Mm.
And so one way we could make the world warmer is by putting Chinese industrial soot all over the Arctic, which will warm the Arctic and warm the atmosphere.
Yeah, we could call it the Black Snow Matters movement or something.
Yeah, the Chinese conspiracy, how to warm the world. Now, what would happen if this was true is that snow would melt more quickly in the spring. So in the previous diagram we saw that in autumn, snow extent was increasing across the whole of the northern hemisphere. So it was growing. There was more snow. But if albedo, if dark snow was causing global warming, then what we would see is the snow melting much, much, much quicker in the spring. And if we look at the spring snow extent, that's exactly what we see. So this is the proper NOAA data from the Rutgers Snow Lab. From Rutgers University, and they hold the snow data, the ice data for NOAA. And you can see that spring snow extent in the Northern Hemisphere has been reducing since the 1970s, just as we might expect. So it's not exactly proof, but it's a nice idea that a lot of the global warming we've been seeing recently has not been caused by CO2. It's been caused by albedo, by reflectivity, snow melting quicker in the spring and therefore the Earth warming up quicker in the spring. Mm. So, yeah. That's all a part of my YouTube video that I've just put on recently on my YouTube channel. So do go and have a look at that. And what it suggests is that the whole of the climate theory, the CO2 global warming theory, is incorrect. And the best illustration of that is exactly what you were saying before, actually, earlier in this talk. And this was summed up also by Josh. I don't know if you've seen the cartoons by Josh. He does a lot of these climate cartoons. And this was his cartoon on the climate computer. So here we have this enormous great climate computer. A bit like something out of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And you've got all the scientists looking at this computer, adjusting the knobs, and they're all down here on the left side. They're all looking at the CO2 knob. But that happens to be the smallest knob on the whole of the computer. The big knob here is the water vapor knob, because remember that the biggest greenhouse gas is water vapor. Water vapor controls 95% of the greenhouse effect.
I would argue that the biggest knobs are the climate scientists, but go ahead.
Well, those as well. But, yeah, so they're not looking at this water vapor one. They're all looking at the CO2 knob. And then you've got this guy on the right side, and he's looked around the corner of the computer, and he's seen something mentioning sun. And nobody's looking at the sun side of it. There's a couple of knobs around there with sun written on them, and nobody's looking at those knobs whatsoever. And there's a guy over here on the left side, and he's shouting here, "Oh, look, I found one that does oceans." But nobody's looking at the oceans knob at all, you know. They're all sitting there looking at the CO2 knob. So as you were saying before, you know, this obsession with CO2, nobody is looking at the other options. And one of the other options should have been on here. There should have been a big knob here for albedo as well, for reflectivity of the surface due snow and ice, because that would be another big one that can affect the climate. But that's not on here either. So, yeah, these cartoons by Josh are quite funny. He's got a whole website full of them, and I think you can buy calendars, Josh calendars, for every year, I think, since 2010, I think. And so they're quite fun.
Well, that's awesome. You can keep the passage of time and the climate lies simultaneously. That's year by year. And in fact, that was another thing. I'd like to see a statistical analysis of climate change projections versus climate change reality. And just have them all, like on a graph of some description, you know, like these were all these different predictions, you know, like in a giant scatter graph and whatever. And here's the actual reality, and nothing happened like that. Or a correlation between climate changer predictions and reality. That'd be interesting. No, it turns out that there's no correlation.
It's an inverse correlation. I think every prediction they've made has been wrong. I don't think there is a single prediction they've made that has been correct.
Yeah, I mean, and they haven't even tried to simple down their prediction so that they'd at least get one. The sun's going to rise tomorrow.
Yeah, that would be the way to do it. You've got to have one that's right.
We've got to lower the bar for these cunts, eh?
This last image is the believer. Because they've got a halo, you see. So they are the pure. They are the virtuous. They've got a big halo. This is the climate believer.
Mm.
Because they're saving the planet. Well, you're not saving the planet. They are saving the planet. And so they are. They've got this enormous great halo behind them.
Do you want to turn your webcam on now, bro? That was quite a fulfilling presentation, bro. I'm very impressed. Very impressed.
I'm still trying to find which knob it is to turn it off.
You've already done it.
Oh, I've already done it, have I? Oh,
that's excellent. Right. You're way ahead of yourself.
It's too complex, all of this stuff. I'm back on. I can see myself now. Yeah, hold on. There I am. Yeah, So, yes, we've had this interesting little saga started with this research paper I did, you know, 3 years ago now, I think it is, which stirred the pudding a little bit. And we've gone on from there into doing more and more of it. But I've seen nothing in the climate world that has demonstrated to me that they know what they're talking about. Absolutely nothing. As you were saying, none of their predictions have turned out to be true. All of their suppositions seem to be rather flimsy. All of their data has been manipulated. What is there to believe about this climate science, you know? Even as we saw, the very basis of climate science,
the only thing they have is belief. The real question is, what is there to know about their climate science? And the answer is nothing.
Yeah, because even their foundation graph, the hockey stick graph, has been falsified. It's been withdrawn. It had so many complaints about the way it was made, the way it was put together, the way the material was covered up, you might say, because no one was telling us what was actually happening with this particular graph, that the IPCC eventually withdrew it. So the very graph that started the whole of this scare story has been withdrawn. And from that, I suppose we could almost go into the renewable industry, because that's a complete nonsense as well. I don't have any graphs on that, but none of the renewables that they've come up with will actually work.
That's true. In fact, one of the things that people who are spouting this whole, oh, it's such good, this renewable energy kind of shit, that they don't take into account is the environmental impact of actually making one of those solar panels. You have to destroy a lot of the environment in order to create one of those, in order to save the environment. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's a scam. Okay, what's the other things on that? Well, let's say you do get one of those solar panels and you put it on your house. Did you know you're not supposed to put it where you are during the day? Because the converters that actually process the energy from the sun create radiation, which cooks you. So that's why if you do put solar panels on your house, you're supposed to put them on your bedrooms, because they're not running at night and won't irradiate the fuck out of you, because you're not spending your time on them during the day. The other part is ultra-low frequency sound, okay? The windmills, these things, they produce this ultra-low frequency sound and they can fuck people up sideways, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yes, indeedy. Now, last thing on that whole thing is the unintended consequences. I know a climate cultist who has a Prius. A Prius which has been shown that the same converters that would irradiate you in your house if you were using a solar panel are the same thing that's running in your car the whole time when you're driving it. So if your idea to save the Earth is to get cancer and die so that you no longer have any environmental impact, you're winning! But if your idea is to save the Earth by actually doing something that's not ineffectual, you're failing miserably. Fuck. I mean, just could people just think through shit before they fucking do it? Oh, I saw an advertisement and I got bribed into it. It just sounds really nice. People like to use Occam's razor. Okay, the most simple explanation is usually the correct one. I don't do that anymore. I'm very cynical. I use Fuckham's razor. If there's two possibilities, one of them is completely fucked and you don't want to believe it, that's probably the correct one.
Yes, well, the whole of those Prius and Leafs and Teslas is on shaky ground anyway at present. I had a minor victory on the Leaf car, because it's made by Nissan, and that came into the UK, and they had these adverts saying the car with no emissions. So I made a complaint, because they've got plenty of emissions. The emissions are just at the power station, not at the car. So I made a calculation that showed that the Leaf was actually putting out more emissions than my diesel car. So I took this to the Advertising Standards Agency in Britain, and they agreed with me, and they said that Nissan should withdraw their advert, because their car is more polluting than my diesel. And so they did, but what they did was they changed the advert. The original advert said the car with no emissions, and so they changed it to the car with no exhaust pipe. So It was still getting around the complaint. I mean, I made another complaint saying it does have an exhaust pipe. The exhaust pipe is that enormous great chimney at the power station. That's the exhaust pipe for the Leaf. But I didn't win that particular one. But yes, these electric cars put out an enormous amount of emissions, because most of the electricity we use is fossil fuel, especially if you're in America, not so much in Britain. But especially if you're in America, something like 70%, 80% of the electricity is fossil fuel. And so your Tesla is run by coal and oil and gas. It's not run by batteries at all. So yes, these renewables, they're always another side to the story. Another good one we've got at present in Britain is Drax the Destroyer.
Mm.
We have this power station in Britain. It's the biggest, one of the biggest in Europe. It's called Drax. It's a 4 gigawatt power station, which is big in power station terms. That's huge. And the EU said we must stop burning coal. And Drax was placed on the top of a coal field. So the coal came out of the ground straight into the power station and was burnt. It was quite efficient. It was quite good. But the EU said we're not allowed to do that anymore. So they've turned it into a wood-burning stove. But we don't have any wood in Britain. So now we've got this new company which is chopping down every single tree in America, processing them into wood pulp, forming them into pellets, shipping them to a port in America, and we've got 5 ships running across the Atlantic on a permanent basis shipping these wood chips across to Britain, and we've got 8 trains in Britain that run these wood pellets down to the power station, and they have to have 1 train every hour to come into the power station with all these wood pellets, and they're now burning wood. And so Drax is now putting out 30% more CO2 than it ever did before, because wood is not such a...
Well, technically, due to the research we just went over, that's actually not necessarily a bad thing for the planet now. But yeah.
Yes, well, precisely, yes. Looking at it from the other side of the window, yes, it's probably a good thing. We want more CO2. But what they haven't done is they haven't achieved anything. For the next 50 years, until these trees sort of regrow, obviously they're going to try and regrow these trees in America. But while they're chopping them down, they've actually increased the amount of CO2 coming out of Drax by an enormous amount. Plus, all of that processing and transportation to get these trees all the way from America to Britain, you know, the amount of energy that's being used to make this renewable energy makes the whole thing just utterly inefficient. And now they're beginning to question whether it was a good idea or not. Having spent a couple of billion pounds on changing this station over to a wood-burning stove, they're questioning whether it was actually a good idea in the first place.
This sounds to me like David Icke was talking about the Hunger Games society and how the Hunger Games was actually split up as each and every district would only produce one particular type of resource. And that way they would never actually be able to provide their own needs or be able to have any independence or break away from the super fascist state. Now, imagine that's happening on a global level where everybody's having their independence taken away, not necessarily just by destroying their laws and legislation and things and human rights and things like that, but yes, that is happening, but specifically by saying you can't access your resources anymore, not unless you ship them all the hell way over there that you don't control, and that kind of same dynamic, isn't it?
Oh yeah, well they're saying exactly the same about Brexit, about us trying to leave the EU. They're saying exactly the same thing. We can't leave the EU because we depend so much on the EU for everything. And therefore, you can't leave. Therefore, you've got to be a part of the European Union for exactly that same reason that you've just said. That is a typical argument that's being used all along because of the international nature of all production now. Mm. You can never be on your own. That's the argument.
And that way, if everybody's dependent, nobody can ever be free.
Yeah, yeah, this is part of what they want. But the going back to the renewables again, it's just not possible to have everyone on renewables. And they still not address, and I've been asking and asking about this from every site, every newspaper, everywhere I've been to. How are you going to make renewables work? Renewables at present depend on wind and solar pretty much, and they don't produce for long periods of time. So obviously solar doesn't produce at night. It doesn't produce during the winter, which is when you want the energy. And wind doesn't produce when you have no wind. So when you get a big anticyclone sets up, you have no wind. Now, I've looked at the charts because I like this weather business. I'm going to have to cough here. Yes, cover up for me. The wind can go off for 10 days. So, okay, we have no wind for 10 days. If you're on a renewable energy grid, you have to have some way of backing up that wind for 10 days. Let's call it a week, but I've seen gaps of 10 days before now. So you've got to have enough energy stored to cover that 7-day gap, say. So in Britain, we use about 50 gigawatts. So what's that? 50 gigawatts times 24 times 7 days. That's 8,400 gigawatt hours of energy that you have got to store somewhere to use on those days. And you can't use a battery. You would need a battery the size of Auckland, you know, to have that amount of energy. So the only way you can really do it at present is by pumped water storage. But nobody has made pumped water storage units that are big enough to hold that amount of energy. And just to give you an idea, we have in Britain, we have the one of the biggest ones in the world, I think, certainly the biggest in Europe, which is called Dinorwig. And Dinorwig is a pump storage system. And Dinorwig holds 2 times 5 holds 10 gigawatt hours. So if we were going to store that amount of energy to cover for a whole week of the Britain having no renewable energy for a whole week, we would need 840 Dinorwig power stations in order to cover us for those days. 840. Now, Dinorwig was the biggest engineering project and the most expensive power station ever made. You would not be able to make that number of backup power stations for these, you know, pump storage power units. And the trouble is, all of these areas where you want to put pump storage are all in the nice sort of national park. And so the Greens won't let you put anything there anyway, because you'll be flooding some valley and you'll be killing some, you know, spiny-backed toad or something, lesser spotted newt, and you're not allowed to put it there anyway. And with Dinorwig, we had this problem because the Greens would not allow them to build the station out in the open. So they built it inside a mountain. And they built the biggest cavern in the world. You could put 2 St. Paul's cathedrals inside it, inside this mountain. So they could put a power station in the middle of the mountain. You can see why it was so expensive. And yet that power station will only give us 10 gigawatt hours. And to back up Britain for a week, we need 8,400 gigawatt hours.
Holy shit.
We're not in the same ballpark. You know, we're nowhere near the same ballpark.
Well, if you reduce the population by 95%, as some have planned to do.
We could do it that way.
Yeah.
No problem. I think 99%, actually, you would need to knock off. But nobody has addressed that situation. So they're all saying, oh, we've got renewables, they're brilliant. You know, Germany, I saw this claim once. Germany last year once had 90% of its energy coming from renewables. Yeah, I looked it up. It was 90% for 2 hours. the sun went down. And there was no renewable at all. And suddenly it was all like 95% coal and well, they don't have nuclear anymore. It was 90% coal and a bit of gas. So these claims are just complete nonsense. This is not what's happening in the energy market. Denmark has the biggest biggest wind array in the whole of Europe. Denmark can rightfully claim to be almost like 80% renewable energy. And everyone holds this up as being the new model for Europe. Look, Denmark is 80% renewable. Yes, but only because it's parked itself next to Scandinavia. So what happens is they've got this enormous amount of wind energy, and of course it's very variable. Sometimes you get a whole load of wind comes in, and what they do is they give that energy to Scandinavia. And Scandinavia uses it and turns off all of its hydroelectricity. And so they're using cheap Danish wind energy instead of hydro. And then when the wind goes calm, Denmark starts screaming and saying, we haven't got any energy. Can we have our energy back from your hydroelectric plants? And Scandinavia says, yeah, of course you can. But you've got to pay for it. And so they sell it. They sell it cheap because they don't want it. They buy it back at like five times the price from Scandinavia. So Scandinavia is going, way, this is wonderful, thanks.
Sounds like a really good sounds like a really good way to siphon a lot of the wealth out of a society.
Yes. So Denmark has the highest energy costs of anywhere in the world. That's what they're paying for this renewable energy. And of course, it only works because they are a small nation in quite windy conditions that is parked right next door to a whole load of mountains that are full of hydroelectric plants. So for the rest of us, for Germany and France, and it's just not possible. There is no storage available for all of this renewable energy. And so what's been happening is that a lot of the grids have been close to blackouts. They call them brownouts when they start losing voltage. And a lot of people have been nearly losing their grids. And they did lose their grid, of course. You remember in South Australia. I know it's a long way from you. It's over by the Nullarbor. But in South Australia, they lost the grid because of their renewables. So what happened? You've got a dual problem here. The wind can disappear and you lose all of your wind energy and you lose your grid and it falls over. And the trouble is you get these cascades. Once you lose one, it'll cascade onto the next one and you'll lose the next station and the next station. And suddenly you've lost the whole of the whole of the state. What happened in South Australia was a little bit different. It's something I didn't realize was so important before. Is not necessarily the amount of energy you're producing with your wind, but its frequency. Energy, our electrical energy is all AC, alternating current, and it operates around the world at 50 hertz. But you have to keep your frequency steady, otherwise the grid will fall over. Because you'll get, one high point on the AC matching a low point and the result will be no energy and the whole thing falls over. So you've got to match the frequency from all of these stations. And what used to happen is we used to have these enormous great coal-fired power stations with a huge great steam rotor because they run by steam turbines. And the rotor in the middle of these steam turbines, it's not like an aero engine where the rotor on an aero engine probably weighs about, 300 kilos or something. These rotors weigh tens or hundreds of tons. I mean, they're enormous great things, and they rotate at a steady, say, 2,000 RPM, and they give us a nice steady 50 hertz. And because they're so enormous, their frequency is very, very steady, very predictable. And everybody matches into that frequency. So all of the other power stations match onto that frequency. Well, once you've got a load of wind turbines, that's no longer true. All of the wind turbines have their own frequency. And you've now got to try and match all of those frequencies from all of these different wind farms all over South Australia with something. But you no longer have a big coal-fired power station for it to match into. So now you're trying to match something onto nothing. And it gets even more difficult to try and keep them all in frequency. Mm. And what happened is they lost the Victoria interconnector. So they had this electrical cable that came across from Victoria, which gave them about 1 gigawatt or something. And that fell over. And then none of the other wind turbines could match any frequency, and they all fell over as well, and they lost the whole state. And so the whole of the state went dark for 3 or 4 hours. And they slowly rebuilt the system back up again and got it working again. But that's what can happen if you run a renewable electrical system, because it's so variable. It's variable in its frequency, and it's variable in the amount of energy you can produce, because the wind can drop, especially in coastal regions where you're dependent on the sea breeze. The wind can drop within 30 minutes. And suddenly you've lost all of this energy. What's going to back it up? Well, at present, they're relying on gas and coal and maybe oil to come and fill the gaps. But of course, in Britain, they want to close down all of our coal-fired power stations because of these EU regulations. So when we lose the wind, what's going to power it up instead? Well, Britain has sort of thought about this, and we now have the strategic reserve. So they've now brought in case all of this happens, the strategic reserve, which will power the essential items like hospitals and, you know, the police forces and the fire brigades and all that sort of stuff are on the strategic reserve. And that is formed from diesel engines. So we now have, they've just bought thousands of these diesel engines, which are scattered all over Britain, which will power the nation if we lose all of our wind, because we've got nothing else to power the nation. We're dependent now on these diesel power stations. And the trouble is that they don't operate all the time. So you've got these diesel engines all over the country, and they operate like 5% of the year. But you've got to pay for them because they're there all the time. You know, the capital cost is still there. And a lot of the renewable costs, you know, the overhead costs of, you know, paying the workers and, you know, the rent and the taxes, you know, the council taxes on the land, all that sort of stuff has to be paid for. Even though you're only using the power stations for like 5% of the year. So the energy coming out of this strategic reserve is the most expensive energy in the world. It's like 100 times more expensive than your average energy. And this is our answer to this problem. But it's no answer at all. Because year before last, we had a very cold... No, last year, we had a very cold winter. 2017, 2018, we had a very cold winter. And our coal-fired power plants were running at 11 gigawatts, which was 10% over their maximum capacity. And they were running at 11 gigawatts for 3 months, full capacity, in order to keep the lights on. Because we had no solar, of course, it was winter, and we had no wind because the wind turbines were covered in ice and none of them were generating any power. And they can't de-ice them. And they had these helicopters going around trying to de-ice the blades because they were all iced up. And they were having terrible problems getting these wind turbines to work in the terrible winter weather. So we were reliant on coal. But those coal-fired power plants are due for closure in the next 3 or 4 years. And so the question then becomes, what on earth do you use? You know, if you get rid of 10 gigawatts of, it's about 20% of our power supply. If you get rid of 20% of our power supply, what on earth are we going to rely on in a cold winter? That will end up with a very, very serious situation. You know, if you lose the grid in the middle of winter, in a northern hemisphere high latitude country like Britain. That would be a lot of problem.
A lot of death.
I don't know if you remember the it'll be death. I don't know if you remember the northeastern blackout. This is going back a bit now, I suppose. It must have been in the late 90s, I think. The Northeast America blackout, where New York lost its energy, lost all electrical energy for like 3 days, 4 days. And some places didn't come back on again for a week. It caused absolute chaos because nothing works without electricity. You imagine it's easier to list what does work than what doesn't work, because the vast majority of your city will not work. You know, you can't get any water because that depends on electric pumps. You can't get any fuel because that depends on pumps. The lifts don't work in the offices, so you can't. Yeah, there's no food because no one's making any bread. There's no transport because the traffic lights don't work. You can't pump any fuel, so there's no transport. There's no trains. There's no aircraft. There's no ship. Nothing is working. And they were lucky because this was midsummer. And so everyone slept out in Central Park, which is brilliant. You had a nice adventure, you know, sleeping out in Central Park. But what if that had been midwinter? Now that would have been fun, wouldn't it? You know, say it was minus 20 outside, it was a freezing winter. Now you lose the electrical grid. Now what are you going to do? You can't even get home. There's no trains. There's no water. There's no food. There's nothing. It would be absolute chaos. It would be every man and woman for themselves. It would be total chaos. But no one is planning for this sort of eventuality. And it will happen. It will happen. It'll probably happen in Germany first, because they are the ones that are most dependent at present on renewables. And they've just closed down all their nuclear plants, so they have no base load. And they've just pledged to close all of their coal-fired power stations. How they think they're going to operate without any coal-fired power stations, I really don't know.
Well, the key word there is think. And there wasn't any of that going on. So,
well, yeah, you do wonder if they are like lemmings jumping off a cliff, you know, if this is designed to destroy Germany. Because Angela Merkel, in her wisdom, said, because of the Fukushima disaster with their power station, we need to close down all our power stations in Germany in case of severe earthquakes. Like, when was the last severe earthquake in Germany? When did Germany last have a tsunami? I mean, like, most of the country is landlocked, you know.
Yeah.
But she closed down all of the nuclear power stations just in case there was a tsunami in Germany. Yeah, down in Bavaria, probably. And you've got to wonder what sort of planet she's on. So why would she do this? I really can't understand it. Why would she want to do this? I mean, there was no good reason for closing down their
nuclear power plants. I know. Well, no good reason, but think of an evil reason. You know, yeah, and suddenly, oh, there's quite a lot of those. Yeah. You know, but before you continue, I want to get on that lemmings comment there. It turns out that the whole lemmings following each other off a cliff thing was actually a fraud perpetrated by the Disney company. They were actually filming these lemmings near the Bow River just outside of Toronto, and they were literally chucking these lemmings off the cliff and then filming them as they fell down. And so it was the scientists chucking lemmings off a cliff, and then instead of going, okay, we frauded everybody, guys, they just made this little documentary, and everybody's like, wow, that's amazing, and nature, and all that kind of stuff. James Corbett from the Corbett Report did an amazing video exposing that one. I got a good native Canadian, you know. But it turns out, ladies and gentlemen, that when you can see a huge threat in front of you, you don't run towards it, strangely enough. No biological organisms do that unless there's something really, really wrong with them. And one example that I could cite there is shrimp in South Texas. The light for a shrimp means death. Okay, and they recorded these shrimp actually just seeing the light and rushing straight forward, and they were wondering, why are they doing that? It's suicide, because as soon as they get out of the darkness and into the light, they're visible to all the little predators that eat the shrimp. So they started grabbing some of these shrimp and testing the water that they were in and everything like that. And it turns out so many Texans are on fucking antipsychotic and antidepressant drugs or whatever. The main side effect of those is, ready? Suicidal thoughts. So what happened was all of that stuff was getting contaminated in the water and then being dumped into the rivers and things like that, and all of these creatures started getting affected with these suicidal tendencies because of a chemical imbalance that was caused by the drugs, not treated by it, you know? So it seems, ladies and gentlemen, that if you really, really want to make people suicidal, drug them, you know, and lie to them. You know, it seems quite simple, especially if you have an anti-human agenda, for example, Agenda 21. So, this is the future under Agenda 21, ladies and gentlemen. A1, if you live in a rural area, you won't. Number 2, if you are having some kind of farm or food production of your own, vegetables, etc., you won't. If you're having any kind of medications to treat any kind of illness and that kind of thing, you won't. If you want electricity to run any of your devices, you won't. Okay, so every single conceivable thing that we have developed technologically within the last couple of hundred years, give or take, is going to be illegal. All right, and the way that they get this to happen is step by step by step. Shut down one power plant, shut down another. And before you know it, we're frogs sitting in boiling water. Now, if we'd been chucked into boiling water immediately, we would have jumped immediately out and go, this is way too hot. But if you're just sitting in cold water and heat it up gradually, we'll just sit there and slowly boil to death.
Well, I hate to follow conspiracy theories, but it does appear to be what they're doing, because the trouble is at present is there is no rational debate about this. So we've had calls again recently from the government that we have to shut all the coal-fired power plants down, but no debate as to what we're going to do to plug the gap. We've had calls again to go fully renewable by 2030 or something it is. No debate on how we're going to back up the renewables in case there's no wind and no solar. We've had a call recently to go all electric cars. No debate whatsoever as to how we're going to generate the electricity. Because if you look at the usage of energy in any country, about 25%, between 20 and 25% is electrical production. Another 25% is transport. So if you're going to make all of your transport into electrical, you've got to almost double your production facilities for electricity. Hmm. Otherwise, you're simply not going to have enough. No thought whatsoever about how we're going to increase power generation in the next 10/15 years to power all these electric cars. Mm. None whatsoever. No explanations, no debate. And if you dare go and try and debate it, you're closed down. No one will talk about it. You're called a denier, you know, a reactionary, you know, you're a heretic. I don't like to join these conspiracy theories, but what on earth are they doing? Are they just thick or something? Is you know, you've only got a couple of options.
The answer there is yes.
Conspiracy.
It's usually a combination. Are there evil people manipulating people, or are people just stupid? Why not both? You know, how is it? I mean, Wouldn't it make it a lot more easy to accept that stupid people were being manipulated by evil people who purposely dumbed them down, you know?
Yeah. So our very organizations that are supposed to sort of protect us, you know, the media organizations that are supposed to inspect these problems and expose them on the television, they are the people who are not doing their jobs because they are in on the same little whatever it is, bandwagon, scam, conspiracy. They are not doing their job by pointing out these problems either. And so the BBC is doing totally the opposite. And they're saying, oh, this is all wonderful. Look, we're going to go all electric by 2030. Yeah, brilliant. But how are we going to do it, chaps, you know?
Well, indeed, those were tasks set out in the new Agenda 2030 document, which is an update of the original 1992 Rio Earth Summit Agenda 21 document that was signed by New Zealand's Prime Minister Jim Bolger. I think, George H.W. Bush also signed it. And this was at the 1992 Rio Earth Summit on Prince Charles's private yacht, I believe. No debate. No, nothing. The agenda for the 21st century, sustainable development. And the brilliance of this is that national sovereignty doesn't matter anymore if all of your local councils are the ones implementing the policy. So if you go into your local city council and you ask them, okay, where's your Agenda 21 booklet for this? And they'll go, oh, well, it's down the stairs behind that bookcase. Blah, 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 blah. You know, they kind of try and hide this stuff, but it's there nonetheless. And when you go in and you look at it and you go, these are crazy frickin' things. No power, no medicine, no roads, no transport, no nothing. Reduce the population by 95%. Blah, 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 blah. Microchip every single human being. Microchip every single animal. Microchip every single fish. This is crazy. This is fucking insane. And, you know, the rational person would go, that's insane, therefore it doesn't exist. Whereas a conspiracy theorist will go, that's insane, therefore insane people are probably behind it. You know, right? Because my definition is a little bit different. I mean, the CIA definition of a conspiracy theorist is somebody who believes, absolutely believes, something they think with no evidence to support it. My definition of a conspiracy theorist is a person who believes, absolutely believes, and you can never convince them otherwise, that powerful people who have a lot of influence will use that power to maintain or grow that influence. That's it. Simple as that. Now, if you own the power grid, if you own the oil companies, if you own the banking system, if you own the media, and they're all kind of lock, stock, and barrel, same kind of clubs of guys and things like that, every single time. Like, for example, you'd go to something like Anarchapulco, which is kicking off reasonably shortly, and you'd get all the anarchists together, and they've all got all this similar knowledge base and all these similar kinds of resources and things like that, and they go around and they hatch all their little anarchistic schemes. Now, what if you had a giant corporate scumbag psychopath pedophile congregation, you know, like a big conference or something like that? What would they do? What would they do together? What kind of schemes would they hatch? And it turns out that the one thing that a psychopath really, really craves above all else is power and control over other human beings that is unaccountable, more or less. And if one were to look at the personality profile of, not to put too fine a point on it, elected representatives, that's the psychological profile that they fit. By and large, I'm not saying that everybody who goes into politics and everything like that is a psychopath. Some of them are just idiots. So they'll get manipulated by psychopaths. Regardless of how smart you are or whatever, there's always a smarter liar. There's always a smarter fraudster who allows themselves to get into those positions of power. And then once they're in there, they've got the power to prevent themselves from ever being taken out of it. All right. And I think this is what humanity as a whole organism, essentially, faces. Let's say humanity was one organism and we're currently infected by a virus. Sam Vaknin identified this virus as narcissism, and psychopathy is a form of narcissism. And he says that what's happened is the human race has been infected by this. And as with all viruses, they don't kill all of the target population of hosts or whatever, because then the virus itself would die off. So what the virus does is it spreads, it becomes epidemic level, and then it kills a good chunk, and then it starts to recede back. Now, this in a historical context is quite interesting. The old saying goes, good times will create weak men. Weak men will create hard times, and hard times will create strong men, and strong men will create good times. And then the cycle repeats itself over again.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are one of the good men living in these dark times and what have you, it is your obligation to do something good in this world, to oppose the viral weaponry that's being deployed against us, be it a psychological, physical, or monetary fucking nature, you know, that kind of thing. Doing the right thing in a bad situation is very rarely the easiest option. And that's why it is only strong people who do the right thing, even if it's the hardest option.
And this is quite serious as well, because I go into this in my book, Mary Magdalene, the Princess of Orange, where I talk about the fall of the Roman Empire and the Renaissance and things of that nature. And we had with the fall of the Roman Empire exactly what you said. Good times made weak people. And that was exactly the problem with the Western Roman Empire. We had the situation where wealthy people were cutting off the thumbs of their sons so they could not join the army because they couldn't hold a sword. People refused to pay their taxes, so the army got worse. It was a very liberal culture. Remember, most of these Roman cities had no walls. This was not a... We think of Rome as being a martial culture, but it wasn't. The legions were all parked on the borders of the empire, protecting the empire. Within the empire, none of the cities had city walls. It was very peaceful. It became very liberal. It was very economically successful, very luxurious. And as you say, good times bred weak men. And it resulted in the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And that fall in the Western Roman Empire came very suddenly. I mean, it was a gradual decline up until, say, 480 AD, and then suddenly it dropped off the edge of a cliff. But when it dropped off the edge of the cliff, something like 70% of the population died. Because they ended his situation, like we were discussing, with the American Northeast blackout when they had their power outage in the Northeast. Because when the Western Roman Empire collapsed, nothing worked. So all of that infrastructure that they built up all over those centuries, all of the transport, the postal service, the aqueducts, the sewage systems, the army, everything stopped working. And suddenly it was every man for themselves. And of course, one of the first things to stop working properly was the agricultural system. And so there was just widespread famine. And 70% of the population died within the space of 10 years. And that's what happens if you lose your civilization. You know, civilization might be very tedious at times, you might say. Lots of hard work. You've got to get up in the morning. You've got to go to work. You only get 2 weeks holiday a year. Rah, rah, rah. We all complain about it. But it's that civilization that we're a part of that keeps us going. And if you take that civilization away, whether it's taking away the societal controls, the army, the police force, or taking away its energy supply, then the civilization falls over. And when the civilization falls over, everybody dies. Because we were talking about being interconnected. We are so interconnected. I cannot grow my food supply where I am. I'm dependent on farmers, wherever those farmers might be, because I can't grow that food. We are dependent. And if the civilization falls over, that's it, you know. Mm. I've got enough food in my cupboards for a week, and that's it.
Yeah.
They did a survey in Britain back in the 80s when we had lots of strikes and things of that nature. And they determined that the nation was 10 days away from revolution at any one time. Because that's how long people would survive on the food in their cupboards before they start marching on the streets and killing other people to get some more food. And so the determination was that the nation is never more than 10 days from revolution.
I think the quote was, a nation is never more than three missing meals away from a revolution.
Well, that's even shorter, yeah. Well, yes, I suppose it depends how much you've got in your cupboards at that point, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was like in the aggregate, if the entire population was hungry for three meals in one whole day, the entire population, there's a revolution right there immediately, that kind of thing. Because the reason why revolutions predictably happen is because they want things to renew. They want things to start again. That's why it's called a revolution. It means to go in a fucking circle. Now, I think that has some evolution needs to actually happen here. We have more knowledge than perhaps the rest of history combined, but we've also got more disinformation and more misinformation than has ever been experienced by mankind in history as well. So that is the problem here, I think, ladies and gentlemen, is that we don't know what we don't know. Okay, and this was coined in 1999, I believe. It was called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where they had subjects come in and they would be asked questions about topics that they think they know a lot about. Like, for example, they would ask me about some kind of conspiracies or something like that. And the point of the test is not to see how much you know about what you think you know, but how much you don't know about what you think you know, and how big of a chasm there is between your confidence in your knowledge and your actual knowledge. All right. Now, the Dunning-Kruger effect is essentially like this. The more you think you know about a subject, the less you actually know about a subject than you think you do. All right. And conversely, it's got a double whammy effect. The less you know about a subject, the more you think you know about a subject. So if somebody comes to me and they say, oh, Vinny, you should be doing this with your editing, or you should be doing that with your radio show, blah, 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 you should be doing this with your website or everything like that, and I'll ask them three questions. How many videos you made, how many websites you got, and how many shows you done? The answer is 000. Okay, fuck off, you cunt. All right, now... It's just that thing. We're so stupid as a species that the dumber we get, the smarter we think we are. And a recent poll in the United States proves this. 96% of Americans believe they're above average intelligence. Okay? Now, if anybody knows anything about statistics, at least 46% of them are fucking wrong about that. Okay, so we've been going for almost 3 hours now.
Yeah. Almost time to wrap up, isn't it?
Indeed it is. So, ladies and gentlemen, before you go away, I would like to ask you for a bit of support. I'm just going to actually be a bit serious with you right now, because last night we were trying to get a new car for me and that kind of thing, and a whole bunch of bad things happened. So last night I had a panic attack. I was shaking, I was crying, I was in a fetal position, I was rocking back and forth in bed, and you know, that kind of thing. It was incredibly fucking stressful, and I wondered what the hell is wrong with me, you know, because I'm in such agonizing stress that I couldn't think, I couldn't talk, I couldn't walk, I couldn't do this kind of shit. And that was simply because I don't have a car, and the person who was supposed to give me one about a month ago betrayed me and decided they weren't going to give it anymore. And just recently, another friend saying they'll give it to me, but there's like, oh, yesterday, or no, it's going to be another week or anything like that, and I just fucking flipped out. So yeah, I'm not in a good place right now, ladies and gentlemen. So if my shows have been a little bit lackluster, if I haven't been getting enough work done and stuff like that, it's because of the associated stresses of simply being let down by people who are close to you and not being in control of my life anymore. That's kind of what causes me to have panic attacks, to realize that I'm in the hands of somebody else. All right, and a really brutal realization hit me is that my friends, my close friends and stuff like that, they're the people who let me down most, right? Whereas my listeners, you people, every time I have asked for help, you have never let me down. And the realization that I had after just coming out of my panic attack is the concept of generosity, all right? One friend, I let him stay with me for a month, and he said he was going to give me his car, and then as soon as he had all his stuff and then moved to a new place, he said, "Nah, I'm not going to give you the car anymore." You know, that kind of thing. That really fucking hurt me, and I can't get over that shit, because generosity is me. You're in need. You need something right now. You can stay at my house for free. No problem. You know, that kind of thing. Greed. Slavery, scumbaggery. That is when you see somebody in need, you have the ability to help them, and you choose not only to do nothing, but you choose to violate your own words, your own promises. A dishonorable thing to do, even to your enemies, let alone friends, let alone people who have sacrificed a lot for you. You haven't done that to me in 10 years. Ladies and gentlemen, you have never offered me something that you have not given. Every time I have asked for something, you have given it. And I am very, very fucking grateful that even though my friends have betrayed me, you have not. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. If there are Kiwis in the audience, there is a Kiwi Bank number on that website there, and I've got New Zealanders starting up automatic payments every week or every month, you know, whether it be 5, 10, 20, 30, 50. I've got one wonderful listener, Michael, who gives me $200 a month, and that's just, I'm so grateful, bro. I'm so fucking grateful. And for those of you who are overseas, you can use Patreon or PayPal. So I just wanted to get that out and get that off my chest, because it's been fucking eating me up inside, bro. Ralph Ellis has been my very special guest. Thank you very much for joining me, mate. Do you have any final statements? Something perhaps a little less depressing than what I just fucking...
On a lighter note, I've been getting into the video business a bit like you. So I'd like to just say that I've now got my video channel. I have mentioned that before. So my video channel is called Ralph Ellis. So no doubt if you do a search for that, you'll find my YouTube channel. I've got a Patreon channel as well, same as you. So I've gone onto Patreon. So what I do is I put half of my videos onto YouTube. And then if you want to see the full video, you have to go down onto Patreon for it. So I've got a Patreon channel called Ralph Ellis as well. And I'm beginning to start to put all of my work on there. So I've got 10 books, of course. So I've got 10 books worth of videos to make. So I've got a lot of videos. I've made 12 videos so far, and I'm probably going to go up to, I don't know, 150 by the time I finish. Anyway, I've got lots of videos to see on there. I've got videos about my books, so this is just straight lectures from my books, and then talks on other topics, topics like this, topics like the climate scams. I had one about zodiacs and lots of different topics. So there's lots of various things of interest. So join me on those, have a look at the videos, see if you like those. And if you like the work, you can go on to Amazon and buy my books as well. So they've got lots of books there, 10 books, mostly about revisionary theology. That's finding the biblical characters and the biblical events in the historical record. And it just so happens that they're all out there if you want to go and have a look at it. And I had this new book as well. I don't think we discussed it actually here. About King Arthur. Did we discuss that one?
We only touched on it, and I think the Arthurian legend, who was it that was telling? It must have been you that was talking about it, because we were talking about how they came back with the truth about Jesus and what have you, but they knew that they'd be executed as heretics if they started just saying, this is actually the true Jesus, bro, and that kind of thing. And so they created this Arthurian legend, who, surprisingly enough, had 12 disciples in a round table with the zodiac and shit like that. And, you know.
Yeah. So that must be out on your channel there somewhere. So if people are interested in that, go and have a look at it. Go and have a look at the Vinnie Ellis talk on King Arthur. It must be out there somewhere.
Well, we didn't do that one specifically about King Arthur, but we touched on it significantly during that show, and I think it was called "Jesus Was a Rich Warrior King." I think was the name of the video.
That was the King of Edessa one.
Yeah.
So yes, I've written another book since then, which is the King Arthur story, and as you say, I go into a lot of it's a 600-page book. It's an enormous book about the truth of the Arthurian legend, that it wasn't about a warrior hero in the 6th century. It was another gospel, basically. It was the gospel according to King Arthur, because that's what it was talking about. This is a very interesting book. It's a very radical thought. No one's ever come up. In fact, most of my books are like this. In all of my books, you will find very, very different ideas and concepts that you won't find anywhere else. And the thing I like about them is they all link up at the end of the day. And a very good example came about this, if we've got just another 2 minutes or so.
We've got as much time as we need.
Was the Hukuk mosaic, which was only discovered like 2-3 years ago. So in my book that we were discussing, the Jesus King of Edessa book, I made an image of Jesus that I thought exactly how he looked. With Roman armor, a beard, orange hair, long hair, etc., etc., diadema headband, stockings, even stockings, because the Eastern people always wore stockings. Anyway, that was my image, and I put him on the front of the book. Now, and that was, I don't know, that was 8 years ago, something like that, anyway. And recently, they turned up a mosaic in Judea of the leader of the Jewish revolt. And I say Jesus, of course, was the leader of the Jewish revolt. And he looks exactly the same. He's got the Roman armor, he's got the stockings, he's got the diadema headband, the orange hair, the orange beard. He looks exactly the same. And so I made this prediction, 5-6 years before this mosaic was discovered. And it was correct. So what I was saying through all that book has been upheld and reinforced by this new mosaic discovery. And that's interesting. And I do a YouTube talk on that as well. So that's why I like this this research that I've done. It's become predictive. Lots of things that we didn't know about are coming out of the woodwork and supporting the work that I've done 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So I think it is 99%, well, maybe 99 is a bit too much, 95% true in all of the books I've written.
And just one last question on that. Who's the guy who wrote that book, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Joe Atwell? I tried to get you two on a show together, and it didn't happen. But then somebody said something that you'd communicated with him or something like that. I'm not sure. I didn't check up on it.
Yeah, we did. We tried to set this up, and Atwell backed out. He didn't want to do it in the end, which is a bit of a shame, because our work sort of overlaps in various places. But he decided not to do it in the end, which is a shame, because we don't have many contacts between the various researchers who are looking at this. In fact, most of the researchers seem to be against each other all the time. I had this big, long discussion with one of the young guys who started now. He was part of the Jesus conspiracist. He was a mythicist, and he was saying that Jesus did not exist at all. And Richard Carrier. And he tried to, because he doesn't agree with my work, he tried to try and destroy everything I'd said. But it turned out during this discussion, we had this big discussion on a website, that he knew nothing about the subject. Everything he said, he got wrong, which was crazy. I mean, he's supposed to be a professor of, I've lost my earpiece. He's supposed to be a professor of theology, and he didn't know any of the subjects I was talking about within my book. So it was a real disappointment in the end. So I had this big discussion with Richard Carrier, and I was hugely disappointed. I mean, he didn't even know that Vespasian and Titus had the same names, and so he got himself into a right muddle. So, yeah, disappointing. So, yeah, there's not much discussion between all of the various researchers on these topics.
Well, it would be good to get you two together at some point or whatever. I think the only one I've managed to get Joe together with is either Jan Irvin, but they got together on their own time, that kind of thing. But recently I got him together with Jeff, the Christian whistleblower. So I got the Christian whistleblower and the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus author on the same show together, and it was fucking magic, mate, you know. But Joe's very I'm not sure if he'll take this as an insult or something, but Joe's maybe perhaps a lot more cautious than me. I might say a little overly cautious or something like that. As you do, if you've created something like that and been given abuse and the moronic kind of blah blah blah, that's not true kind of shit you do, certain people can develop a dislike of even the possibility of having a debate or a discussion with somebody else. In the quite right knowledge, not fear or anything like that, but in the knowledge that there's a good possibility that it'll just turn into some kind of shit fight and be unpleasant and accomplish very little. But however, he did research into his stuff, but I think it was because Jeff had researched into his stuff first. So if you read the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus and then go to Joe and said, man, it was great, I love that, I'd like to add some few things onto there, boom, the conversation happened. But if people go in completely unaware of what somebody's actual information is and what their work actually entails, it's very, very difficult to be all forthcoming and happy about it, kind of thing. So I can completely understand why Joe sometimes does that kind of thing. But regardless,
The other way. I've got more confident as time has gone on, because you have these discussions, and I've had discussions with especially on blogs with people who disagree, and I've become very confident because I can answer any of their questions, any of their points that they want to make against my theory, I can answer it, and so it's made me very confident about debating with these people. But they don't want to debate with me because I feel that they lose the argument far more than I would ever lose the argument. And then, as you say, they just revert to abuse and start, what do you know? And so you don't end up with a rational conversation, or they go on to another topic. So you defeat them on 10 topics, and then they find one small thing that you might not know about. So, you don't know anything, do you? Even though I've just defeated them on 10 topics previously, you know. Yeah. I did this with a professor from, I forget where he came from now. He was American. And he went through my book and he lost all of these arguments. And then finally he said, look, you've got the wrong S on the end of this Greek name. Because there are two S's in Greek. There's the standard S and then there's the ending S. And one of my words had the wrong S on the end of it. And he said, well, look, you've got your Greek is totally wrong, so you don't know anything.
And let me guess, you replied by typing FFS? That's text language, for fuck's sake.
Yes.
And I use the correct
ism. That's what it comes down to sometimes. It really does. It comes down to, they've got to find one little hole somewhere. Ah, you've got one letter wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, the book is 600 pages. I got one letter wrong. Sorry.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, I have to be God now, do I? I have to be fucking infallible for you to believe my shit, nigga. I mean, for fuck's sake. It just... Okay, look. The world has become a worse place because of mainstream education and mainstream media. Okay? I think everybody believes that to be true. Intellectually, we are becoming infantile. All right. We are, as a species, growing out of our intellectual infancy. And some of us refuse to grow the fuck up. And I don't know if anybody has seen Spaceballs, but when at the very end, where Dark Helmet's like rushing at him and he's just holding his helmet, you know, and he can't get me. That's what it's like arguing with one of these people. And it's almost like... You don't realize that there's no point to what you're doing, do you, bro? You're that fucking infantile. There could be, instead of a debate, a discussion, right? I looked up the definition for argument one time because somebody accused me of trying to argue with them. And I was like, that's weird. I was just trying to have a conversation. And I looked up the method, what argument actually means. It's when two people present what they think they know and listen to each other. That's what a fucking argument is. Right? And I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but I've seen a hell of a lot of people say these words. Oh, I don't want this to turn into an argument. You mean you don't want it to turn into two people listening to each other and sharing our ideas and shit? Well, you know, that's kind of self-evident. You didn't even need to fucking say it. Oh, my God. It's just frustrating. But in either case, that's the reason why I like having these conversations and almost very few other kinds of conversations, to be frank, Ralph, because there ain't a lot of good conversing going on out there, is there? And it's good that we can at least find somewhere that is good. Nice.
Yeah.
Friendly. Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Ralph. Edfu-books. Oh, wait. What was it? Edfu? Yeah. Edfu-books. It's an anagram for fuck you education. You've been...
Edfu, yes.
But in either case, yes, we've got to end the show. I'm out of water. I'm out of coffee. And ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Vinny.
And we'll see you again.
Cheers.